The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Mike Ludwig about his exclusive piece, Under Industry Pressure, USDA Works to Speed Approval of Monsanto's Genetically Engineered Crops. That's right. We are speeding through the regulatory process to make sure all those genetic modifications, all of that made-up food stuff, well, gets through the process quicker. We don't need to know what any of that stuff is. Just eat it. Be happy it's there. Just like, you know, high fructose corn syrup is now corn sugar because it tastes just the same, just like sugar. Nice. Talk to Mike about that. Also in the second hour, Ted Martin, equalitypa.org, going to be here talking about a equality resolution that's being discussed here in the state. And in the third hour, Philip Jennings, General Secretary of UNI Global Union in the country for the UN Global Compact Board meeting. Going to talk about labor rights around the world, a little bit of Walmart, and whatever else pops up during our conversation. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So, last night, huge victory for the kids in this state, a huge victory for taxpayers in this state, not such a good night for the profiteers, not such a good night for the Republican leader, not such a good night for the, well, the moneyed interests. Surprisingly, you know, heaven forbid, the people actually won out on this one. And you gotta love some of the stuff that's been coming out, the tinky tanks, and oh, it's a bad day. You know, you can't have freedom without choice. To which one woman tweeted back, yeah, that's what she said, talking about, you know, choice for women. This group, the Center for Education Reform, they put out an angry, ticked-off letter, saying, you know, we had an opportunity and they let us down. And because I don't think Republicans are going to be able to go to their ALEC meetings or their society club dinners. I don't think they're going to be able to do that with their heads up anymore. You look around to the other states; they got their marching orders and they followed through. Here, not so much. Here, what happened is some of the sane, rational Republicans, the ones who are saying, party's going a little too far. We need to rein that in. This isn't the direction that even the Republicans in this state want to go. And look, you know, there used to be a time in this country where we agreed on a lot of things, education being one of them. And the fact that we didn't want the billionaire class privatizing that and profitizing it. We used to think that way. And I think most of us still do. But the handful of people who are in control for now, people like Majority Leader Terzai, they needed to get the message. And look, you got to be honest. The push back against the vouchers, push back against the wine and spirit shops, that looks like it's dead. push back against, you know, screwing with the prevailing wage. That looks dead. So pretty happy. Also, some numbers came out, which, again, you know, you look at what's going on here, and you kind of got to go, well, what are we going in the right direction with education? And this Center on Education Policy, they just issued a new report that shows more than 43,000 schools in this country, or 48% of all schools in this country, failed to make adequate yearly progress. Florida was the high, with 89% of their schools failing to meet adequate yearly progress. Wisconsin had the best, 11%. Pennsylvania, on the better end, 28%. But, you know, here's the thing. The number of failures has gone up. In 2010, we were down to 17%. We were heading in the right direction. You go back to 2008, it was 28%. 2009, 22%. 2010, 17%. So the Rendell policies were working. We were getting better. We were moving towards a better educated school kids. We were actually making progress. 2011, boom, right back up to 28%. And why is that? Could it be the $960 million we stole from education? Could that be it? Could it be we were on the right track and the people who took over in 2010 have completely screwed it up? You know, when you fire 14,000 teachers and support staff across the state, that's got to have some impact on the kids sitting in the classroom. It's got to have, just my thought, it's got to have some impact. And you look at all the cuts that have gone around this country. The fact of the matter is there are 43 states plus Washington, D.C., 43 states where more than a quarter of the schools failed. 24 states in D.C., half of the schools failed. And in five states, you had five states where more than three-quarters of the schools failed. I mean, to me, that is just absolutely mind-blowing. And it all comes down to cut, gut, and punish. It all comes back to, for me anyway, to the fact that we have stopped investing in this. And I'm hoping that next year we don't see another uptick in this. Because, again, you know, the next budget that's going to come out is going to have more of the same, more of the same punishment, more of the same cut, gut, and punish policies. Going to cost our kids that much more as we go forward. And, you know, they were, the Citizens for Reform or the Center for Education Reform or whatever they are, the billionaire front group, they said, you know, there's some good Democrats out there. You know, people like Tony Payton and Tony Williams, good Democrats. They were courageous. And there's part of me that goes, no, they were opportunist. There was some money there. And I happened to see this Forbes magazine story that I... Well, the guy who wrote the story, okay? So the guy who writes this story for Forbes, he describes himself as, you know, a short, portly, a guy who good enough's enough. You know, someone who, you know, well, you know, good enough is always enough. Kind of lazy, you know, that kind of thing. So he's... The title of the piece that he's talking about, If I Were a Poor Black Kid, is the title of his article. You know, guy, basically stale, male and pale, here he is. He said in his little bio, I admit, I'm short, balding, and mediocre. He's a mediocre certified public accountant. He says his biggest downfall is if it's close enough, it's good enough. So this guy, if it's close enough, it's good enough, a mediocre accountant, he's writing a piece, If I Were a Poor Black Kid. So you know, it's got to be mediocre, and it's got to conform to that, right? Well, no. He's going after Obama for last week, saying that there's inequality in the country. In fact, he picked out the quote that I used, where Obama said, "This is a defining moment in our time. This is a make or break moment for the middle class, and for all those people who are fighting to get into the middle class, because what's at stake." Is whether we'll be a country where working people can earn enough to raise a family, build a modest savings, own a home, secure their retirement. And he says he's right, and I agree. This is a make-or-break time. So he goes, if you know, if I were this poor black kid in the inner city in Philadelphia, what I would do? And he begins by saying, I'm not a poor black kid. I'm a middle-aged white guy who comes from a middle-class white background. So life was easier for me. So right from the start, he's already telling you he's full of it. He has not a clue what he's talking about, but he feels emboldened to throw in his two cents. So he throws in, he says, but it doesn't mean that the prospects are impossible for those black kids in the inner city. It doesn't mean that there's no opportunity for them. Let me reiterate his words from earlier. I'm not a poor black kid. I'm a middle-aged white guy who comes from a middle-class white background. So life was easier for me. So understand, right from the beginning, he's telling you, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm going to continue anyway. He goes on to say, life is tough, sure, but, the 1% controlling the world, and the rest of us fighting for scraps isn't how it is. And I read that, and I'm going, wait a second, that is how it's set up. The investor class rules. They're the ones who put people on the unemployment line. They're the ones who move factories out of inner cities. They're the ones who move factories out of the country. They're the ones who do a lot of the negative things that have gone on in this. They're the ones who collapsed Wall Street. They're the ones who go after social programs and destroy those. So explain to me why it is that you don't believe the 1% is controlling the world. he goes into that a little bit, but you know it's coming. The whole Horatio Alger thing, he writes, it takes brains. It takes hard work. Remember, the guy who, if it's good enough, it's good enough. It takes hard work, a little luck, and a little help from others. It takes ability and know-how to use the resources that are available, like technology. Oh, the black community is saved. There's technology. He says, as a person who sells and has worked with technology, I also know this. Here's the problem. Sadly, these kids, these poor inner city kids, and I was one of them, don't have techie parents to guide them. So there's a pretty sizable problem there that he's not really willing to go into. So he goes into it. If I were a poor black kid, I would first and most importantly work to make sure I got the best grades possible. Wow. Wow, good for you. The guy who, remember, mediocre accountant. Remember, if good enough's good enough. Now, stop and think about this. What he doesn't understand, he's already told you, lives in a nice, safe neighborhood. Life's been easy. Having a safe place to live helps. Having food on the table always seems to help. And good grades are important, too, but the survival, I think that's pretty important, too. He goes on to say, I would make it my number one priority to read sufficiently. I wouldn't care if I was a student at the worst public school in the worst inner city. Even the worst have the best. I love that. That's a great way. That's a great line, don't you think? Tell those kids, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, kids. Here's what middle-class white guy, who probably couldn't find a poor neighborhood on a map, doesn't seem to understand. In these type of neighborhoods, survival is first and foremost. Survival. That means thinking about the next 5 minutes, not the next 5 years. And I know this concept is foreign to people like our mediocre accountant. I know that. And the reason I know this scenario is because I used to be this kid. When I was 10, 12, 13, I didn't realize college was a place you went to get an education. I thought it was the next place you went to play sports. And my mother always said, I want you to college. I want you to, have a good job. And I never knew what that meant. We need so much more than rhetoric. So he goes on to say, I would use the technology available. Again, back to the technology. And it's a great idea. We should be funding more tech programs. We should be funding more of these programs in inner cities. I'm right there with you. Why is it in this article that he doesn't say anything about funding? And the question I have is, what technology would you go after? So he goes into saying, if I were a poor black kid, I'd use the free technology available to me, like Google Scholar and Spark Notes and Cliff Notes. So he's telling the poor black kids, just read Cliff Notes. Now, remember, the mediocre accountant. Maybe this is how he got through, but you kind of have to wonder. He goes on to say, well, I would watch relevant teachings like Academic Earth and TED and Khan Academy. And I like Khan Academy. I think he does great work. But TED? I can't even sit through most of the lectures that TED puts out. And he says, go and use CIA World Book Facts and go and use Wikipedia to learn to do research. Wikipedia? Really? Is that what you're telling him? And he goes on, he gives some other, you know, some reasonable ideas, which I think is okay. But what if the kids don't have computers? You know, I know in white middle-class suburbia, that's not a problem. But in inner cities, it kind of is a problem. And I know what you'll say. They could just go to the libraries. Right. You mean the one that they've been closing down because it's been underfunded? You mean those libraries? With the computers that are probably the old 486s? Right. Let's get right on that. And he goes on to say, well, you know, if I were a poor black kid, I'd make it my goal to get into one of these really rich schools, one of these private schools, one of these high standard schools. And that's a great idea. I'm all in favor of it. But I love what he writes, and I gotta read the paragraph. He says, even a private school, most private schools I know of are filled to the brim with the 1%. That's because these schools are exclusive and expensive, costing anywhere from $20,000 to $50,000 a year. But there's a secret. I've got to tell you, there's a secret. Most of them have scholarship programs. Most have boards of trustees that want to give opportunities to kids who can't afford them. Many would provide funding for not only tuition, but also transportation and even boarding. Trust me, they want to show diversity. And here it comes, the money shot. They want to show smiling, smart kids from different colors and races on their fundraising brochures. Okay. Is that the best you got? So he goes on to say, you know, and you can't make this up. So many kids from West Philadelphia don't even know these opportunities exist for them. Many come from single-parent families whose mom or dad, or in many cases grandmom, is working two jobs to survive and are just too plain tired to do anything else in the few short hours they're home. Many have teachers who are overburdened and too stressed to find the time to help every kid that it needs. Many of these kids don't have the brains to figure this stuff out for themselves, like my kids. Here it comes. Except my kids are just lucky enough to have parents and a well-funded school system around them to push them in the right direction. So my question to my Forbes writer is, what are you talking about? If you were the poor black kid, you wouldn't know any of these things exist because we're not funding this stuff. And even you yourself have said that your kid has the leg up because they go to a well-funded school. This is the kind of hypocrisy that drives me insane. This is the kind of nonsense that comes out of places like the Tinky Tank with a whole bunch of self-indulged, self-serving narcissists who only care about how much money they can put in their pocket, and they don't care about the people that they claim to be advocating for. They probably couldn't find them if they wanted to. Quick break, right back after this.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'm an announcer winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up at 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America for the better.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wednesday was a national day of action protesting a new law that would allow the use of the U.S. military inside the country against U.S. citizens. Occupy Washington, D.C. sat in at U.S. Senator Carl Levin's office to protest the proposed law. Occupy's Kevin Zeis says this radical change in law would allow the use of the U.S. military against protesters and would allow the military to grab citizens off the streets and hold them indefinitely based on mere suspicion of being engaged in hostilities against the U.S. It's a major shift since the U.S. has largely banned the use of the military inside the country against citizens under the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878. The 200 striking IAM members at Wisconsin's Manitowoc Cranes are resisting the company's efforts to destroy union rights. Wisconsin's labor movement says the company is mimicking Scott Walker's attack on public worker collective bargaining. OPEIU Local 9 business rep Dawn Martin.
They should contact Manitowoc Cranes and tell them that they should get back to the negotiating table, pull this terrible language off, and this strike is over. I mean, that's all it takes.
Four of the 26 OPEIU workers at Manitowoc Cranes have been laid off due to the strike. OPEIU workers join the IAM picket line when they're off work.
Christmas is coming, and these are families who are doing without, and I can tell you that we are supportive and involved in a food drive and toy drive for the families of the strikers. Any support for them can be done through the Machinist District 10.
A coalition of California education groups is calling budget cuts to education unconscionable. Jesse Russell reports.
At the heart of the discontent is a trigger that would see more than $240 million slashed from home-to-school transportation. The impact on schools from the cuts will be disproportionate due to a formula based on growth that determines where funding goes. The Los Angeles Unified School District wasted no time in filing a lawsuit to protest the cut because that district would be losing $38.6 million. During a conference call on Wednesday, members of the Education Coalition spoke out against cuts. Classified School Employees Association Executive Director Dave Lowe.
Thousands of children will be forced to walk to school. They'll be walking through dangerous streets and intersections, through neighborhoods with hundreds of registered sexual predators and criminals. This is just completely unconscionable.
California Teachers Association President Dean Vogel said the education system in California is at a crossroads. He said there needs to be revenue.
We believe that California, with the eighth largest economy in the world, sitting right about 46th in per pupil funding, is a disaster waiting to happen. And we've got to wake up, and the policymakers need to wake up.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, you can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, or give us a call here at the station, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So today, back in 1791, Virginia was the last state to ratify the Bill of Rights, but today the Bill of Rights became law. The folks who were the anti-federalists, the people who criticized the Bill of Rights, were afraid that they were too strong. We had too strong of a federal government, and they didn't want that because they thought it was another king. But you, the first 10, your Bill of Rights today. So that's outstanding news. Let's go to the phone line. It's got Ike on line one. How you doing tonight, Ike?
Hey, brother. The law about, not using the military against its own population.
Yeah, Posse Comitatus.
Well, let me ask you something. What happened at Kent State, and were those military or not? So, in other words, the National Guards are exempt?
Well, they declared an emergency, and they can call out the National Guard. The governor can do that. But here's my thought on this. If I remember right, and I think I may, during the Bush years, we pretty much did away with that, along with habeas corpus. So both Posse Comitatus and habeas corpus in this country, as long as you can call it part of terrorism, no longer exists.
Right, under the Patriot Act,
right.
Correct. And here's the other point. You know what? You know, if you dress your police up as stormtroopers, I guess they're de facto military anyway, aren't they?
Well, if you listen to Mike Bloomberg, he claims he's got the eighth largest army on the planet. So,
Exactly. So, you know, you know, when 1984 got here and they blended the, you know, the vernacular and they blurred the lines like they continue to do, up is down and down is up and et cetera.
War is peace.
You know, yeah, they're already there.
Yep.
But one other thing on the education deal, you know what this is really all about?
Money.
Yeah, well, it's not just that.
Control.
But, you know, these rich white folks, you know, particularly these rich white folks,
yep,
that want their little kids to go to Jesus school or
it's part
they
of
want
it.
To keep them home or whatever. You know what that's really all about?
Yeah, I mean, it's about controlling their kids.
They don't want their kids going to school with the kids of the people that they hire to do their dirty work. In other words, i.e., immigrants.
Or black kids, or however you want to put it.
Yeah, well, I'll put it to you this way. The graduating class here in South Carolina is going to be 6% Latino. By the time 12 years rolls around, the next group that's going to graduate from high school is going to make up 22% of the graduating class.
Wow.
So, in other words, what I'm saying here is they're good enough to work in their yards, and they're good enough to take care of their kids, and they're good enough to do all this, but their offspring, they don't want their kids around them.
Yep.
They don't want their kids around anybody that doesn't believe in Jesus, the Republican Party, et cetera. And I've got something just to put to you, you know, for anybody out there that's listening. This is what the 99% and Occupy Wall Street needs. Somebody needs, that's computer literate, needs to get together and make an app and put an app out there to where we've got full access to the charts, to the evidence, and to the movement to the point that, hey, we're going to, you know, this is going on, that's going on, yada, yada. They need to build an app. Stick it up on the Android, you know, make it available for Android, iPhone, et cetera, and let's get organized.
Yeah, that works all fine, well, and good.
Go.
That works all fine, well, and good until they flip the kill switch.
Well, yeah, but until then, we can use it.
Good
point. And beyond that, then once they flip the kill switch, it doesn't really matter because we'll have, you know, we'll have mirror sites. And we'll have other ways to communicate.
And I know there are a couple of groups out there who are trying to form their own alternate internet, just in case that happens.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So good.
And by the way, you know, I'm glad to know that on the weekend of my birthday, I now have something to connect it to. I was actually born on a day that the Bill of Rights came into being, and that actually makes me feel like that's why I am the way I am, because I saw a bumper sticker years ago when I was volunteering down in Biloxi after the hurricane, and it was an old hippie guy, you know, whatever, and one of his bumper stickers, you know what it said?
What's that?
Ignore your rights and they'll go away.
Excellent
and
point.
That's what's going on.
Well, let me wish you a happy birthday, Ike.
All right, my friend, and, you know, hey, I think I got three more lives left. That's what I hear.
There you go. Thanks so much, man. Always great talking to you. And no, look, this whole privatization of education, it's about a couple of things. One, it's about, first and foremost, for the billionaire class, it's about the money. It's about privatizing, profitizing it, and making it proprietary. 2+2 is now something that we're going to have to buy to test our kids on so that they can make big money off of it. Secondly is, you know, you've got these people who want ultimate control over their fashion accessories called children. They want to put in their mind everything their kids think, everything they see. They want total control over these robots that they call children. They don't want them having brains of their own or becoming critical thinkers, because they may turn around and go, you know, you were really crummy parents, or you're really not that bright either, or what you believe is insane. That's what parents fear the most. And then there's the other part of it, the business component, that they don't want critical thinkers. They want button pushers. And I think George Carlin said it
they
best.
They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest.
That's right.
You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers, people who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly easier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back. So they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club.
Light bulb.
Yeah, and think about when he said that. Probably pushing 20 years now. This has not been something that just happened. The wealth class owning everything didn't just happen. It's been a long process. And now we're seeing the Occupy people out in the street. Good. We're seeing people shutting down ports. Good. We're starting to see people take direct action, not just here, but around the globe. So finally, the working people of this country are waking up and saying, you know, we've had enough. I've been working my butt. And this isn't liberal, conservative, right, left, Democratic, Republican. These are people who are working their behinds off. And not being able to pay their bills. That's what this is about. Pretty simple stuff. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. What do you think? Right back after this.
Changing America for the better.
Great news, people. A hot spot of non-spotted ladybugs has been spotted in Amagansett, New York. This uplifting story is a rich organic mixture of state pride, nature's resilience, America's scientific pluck, teamwork, serendipity, and bug love. In today's hard times, we need this. Let's start with the bug. This ladybug is the classic cochineidae beetle with exactly 9 black spots on its red back. A benevolent and delightful creature, it's beloved by everyone from children to farmers. So beloved that it is the official insect of New York State. Sadly, and somewhat embarrassingly, however, this state official has bugged out of the state. The last recorded sighting of this ladybug species in New York was 29 years ago. Apparently a victim of competition from imported Asian and European ladybug species, as well as pesticides and the loss of habitat, only 90 of the native 9 spotteds have been seen in all of North America in the past decade. But since 2000, a team of diligent Cornell University entomologists and volunteers have kept up the search through Cornell's Lost Ladybug Project. The searchers persisted, even when New York's legislators tried in 2006 to abandon the bug that seemingly had abandoned the state. Luckily, though, legislative inertia killed that effort to replace the state insect, and the Ladybug Project kept faith and kept looking. Then, this summer, lo and behold, a volunteer spotted one sitting pretty as you please in a patch of sunflowers on an organic farm in Amagansett. About 20 more were subsequently found on the farm amidst rows of carrots, beans, and flowers, enough for the project to establish a reproducing colony, while also building confidence that more will be discovered. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep up with this bit of good bug news, go to lostladybug.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out. HightowerLowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I got a list of demands, written on the palm of my hand. Number one, this is you are the right man. We live in and about to want a piece of money. See somebody try to free somebody. Got a list of demands.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. So a record number of Americans, nearly 50%, are either in poverty or considered to be low income, according to census data. The data shows a shrinking middle class, and we've been talking about this all week. The numbers have been dwindling, and California saw a huge shift of people in that massive middle. It used to be like 65% of the people were in the middle class. It's down in like the 40 range now. So you're looking at this, you're looking at people falling out of the middle class, falling into low-paying jobs, falling into poverty. And we've seen years of stagnant wages. We've seen years, a couple years now of high unemployment. In fact, they keep telling us, get ready. You know, this is the new normal. 7.5%, 8%, that's going to be the new full employment number. Nonsense. We've also seen, you know, high healthcare costs, high costs of living, and of course the safety net that used to help keep people from falling into poverty. Well, the Republicans have been taking a machete to that. Sheldon Danziger, a public policy professor at the University of Michigan, said the reality is that prospects for the poor and the near poor are dismal. If Congress and the states make further cuts, we can expect the number of poor and low-income families to rise over the next several years. And look, you know that's coming because they've already told you, cut, cut, and punish. We're going to slash, we're going to slash, we're going to slash, so that the confidence fairy will come back and sprinkle its dust. And then supposedly a massive explosion of an investment and job creation is of really high-paying jobs, voluntary high-paying jobs, are going to spring up out of the pixie dust. And if you believe that, I've got a whole bunch of brand new bridges just built. We can get those out to you really cheap. Kind of nonsensical. Anyway, I like what the president did today. It is the 18th initiative in his We Can't Wait campaign. It is going to raise the wages of home health care workers. You know, originally people thought if they work in somebody, you know, if you have home health care workers, they're just some people who come and babysit old people. They're just like babysitters for children, but only older. But the reality in this is that this has turned into a $70 billion industry where corporate America has, well, they have really done very, very well because they found a loophole in the law where they could exploit workers, especially on the lower end. And since the economy's in the tank anyway, you've got people who just need something. So you went out, we trained all of these people to be home health care aides and nurse's assistants, and then you put them in the jobs where they can't even make minimum wage. I mean, stop and think about that for a second. Not even minimum wage. So the president has said, you know what, we're going to put those folks, give them minimum wage and overtime protection. Here in Pennsylvania, Rendell, I guess, did that a couple years ago, but throughout the country, it's not how it is. And here's the reality. As the days go on, we're going to see every day for the next 18 years, they say 8,000 people every single day are going to turn 65. We are going, one in five people by 2050 will be over the age of 65. And as I've been saying for the longest time, don't wish the immigrants away. Don't wish we block off the borders, because we're going to need somebody when Jake takes invalid and when I take to be an invalid to come and wipe my nose. That's going to have to happen. And those people are going to need to make at least a living. And I want them to make a living, especially when you're looking at the kind of money that these healthcare executives are just stealing from us every single day. And the reason I bring up the healthcare executives, well, John Hammergren, CEO of healthcare provider McKesson. Have you ever heard of McKesson? I haven't. But he made $145 million last year. $145 million for a company that I've never heard of. And you look at the news that's out, you see the executive pay, again, nicely going up. They're saying anywhere between 27 and 40%. The CEOs in this country have seen their wages go up. You and me? No. We've actually flatlined. And we've been flatlined for 30 years. The company that did it, GMI Rating, they took a look at some 2,647 companies. These are the people who offer comprehensive assessments of what they put out. They went in, they looked at all the data, they compiled it, and they came up with the 27 to 40% number. So again, you know, you look at this and you go, you got these big CEOs, they're filling their pockets, but the workers, well, the workers are getting screwed. And you wonder why there are people in the streets. You wonder why people are looking to the top 1% and saying, enough already. Don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, you wonder when the light's going to be turned on by the people in power. When are they going to understand that if we keep going this way, the wealthy and the corporations are not going to be able to make their profits. You want to enhance the wealth of a rich businessman? What you have to do is create demand. How do you create demand? You create demand by providing jobs for people so they can make a good income. And if that income isn't there, the spending isn't there, the demand isn't there, and your profits for your business isn't going to go up. Now, maybe there's one exception, but that, you know, that's the healthcare industry, but that window, thanks to some legislation by the Democrats, although we don't think it's enough, it's a start. They're starting to limit their profits. However, long term, even in healthcare, your profits are going to be diminished. And in the end of the, what I'm trying to say is, we have to start creating jobs. That is actually a long term survival thing for this country. It's as simple as that. We can't be a service industry. We can't be a service country.
So our friend, our CEO Hammergren, $145 million this past year. That's what he put in his pocket. And what the article is saying is his biggest payday is yet to come. I guess there's an opportunity that the company is going to be bought out, and he has in his contract, if the company changes ownership, he gets a handout of $469 million, close to $500 million. Now, I remember when the company that I worked for got bought out. The only thing I got was I lost seniority. The only thing I got was more job insecurity. And the only thing most of the people who got laid off was is here's some unemployment and good luck in your next career. This guy, because he's got a nice big fat contract, $469 million. Really? And they say this with a straight face. And understand that $469 million will be taxed as a capital gains because it's a stock buyback. 15%. And I look at this and I go to what's going on in D.C. The fact that they would refuse to raise taxes on someone like that to make sure that the middle class in this country has an opportunity to pay their bills and to maybe have a touch of luxury, just a touch. Maybe a movie every month, maybe take the wife out to dinner, something. And heaven knows that might actually help stimulate the economy, but we can't get that done. You know what we can do? Here in the state of Pennsylvania anyway, there's a House bill. Blew my mind. House Bill 1100 is going to exempt the sale of private and corporate airplanes. No airplanes. No, we're not gonna tax those corporate jets. No. Gonna cost us anywhere from $10 to $14 million, which is basically just a handout to the very wealthy, because they're gonna buy the planes anyway. I don't know that these tax incentives actually increase the amount of demand for airplanes. I don't. So when I go to the store, and I like what Sharon Ward from the Budget and Policy Center said. You know, your car muffler, it'd be subject to a sales tax, but the landing gear on the airplane, no, not so much. So if it's for me, I'm going to be taxed on it. But the guy who made $469 million when the company gets sold, and he buys his jet because he wants to go around the globe, he pays no taxes. Again, I ask, fairness? You be the judge, because maybe I'm skewed. Maybe the righties are correct. Maybe that, you know, that's how we're going to create jobs, by giving these rich people the opportunity to spend more of the money that they've been hoarding, you know, buying planes. Now, if you remember, the whole idea was, a couple years ago, they exempted Chinook helicopters from any taxation. And the idea was, well, they're going to create jobs. And the reality is it did. It created jobs in New Jersey, not here in Pennsylvania, which is kind of hysterical. But 1100, that's, you know, get a nice handout to the wealth class. And again, they never lose. The wealth class never loses, Jake, because they've got the money. Well, they've got the money to pay off their politicians. They've got the money to, you know, to grease the palms. That's why we got to get money out of this system. It doesn't get any simpler than that. But there just doesn't seem to be that will there. There doesn't seem to be that push. I know there's a couple of groups, Move to Amend, to try and get rid of Citizens United. I know there are a couple of groups out there that are trying to go to publicly funded elections. But it's got to be louder.
Bernie Sanders, in fact, was on TV tonight, and he's leading the charge. I think that's great news. I would rather have Bernie Sanders than anyone else in the Senate leading the charge. But something has to be done. I mean, it was bad enough prior to Citizens United. It was a huge amount of cash going into the system prior to this. Now there's just oceans. It is overwhelming the system. I mean, are we kidding ourselves if we think we still have a true democracy after Citizens United? We are kidding ourselves.
It'll be interesting to see what happens in Wisconsin because out there, I guess they're like 30,000 signatures away from having enough votes, enough signatures for the recall. So it looks like it's going to happen. Now the question becomes, how many more do they get? You look at Ohio. I think Ohio needed like 230,000. They got 1.3 million.
They said they were looking at over 700,000, but about 7.5 just to cover their...
To make sure.
Yes, yes.
And it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how much money pours into there. If Walker actually raises the $70 million that some people have been saying, you know the wealth class is behind him. If they short him and he raises like $20 million, you know they gave up on him. And they're just gonna give him a nice cushy job in one of their think tanks, and he'll be well taken care of for his kind work for their cause. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Let's take a quick break right here. Back with your calls.
Red boots and two, I see them blue. Only and you, and I say to myself, oh, wonderful world.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. A living wage, health benefits, safe working conditions. These aren't privileges to be taken away. They're rights to be protected. This is Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Public services and workers' rights are under attack like never before. But the Main Street movement is pulling together. Nurses, firefighters, cops, teachers, students, and neighbors. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Coming after workers and their unions? It's a shameful agenda for Wall Street politicians, but AFSCME's been in this fight for 75 years. We're not about to stop now. Join the Main Street movement at AFSCME13.org. And from all of us at AFSCME, happy holidays.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So I got an email yesterday, and I wanted to get to this yesterday, but, you know, Romney's been taking kind of a beating over his $10,000 bet, as well he should. You know, I saw one funny ad that said, oh, you know, when we gambled, we bet nothing but 100 large. I don't know what Mitt's talking about, this 10 grand stuff. But someone sent me a list of all the things that someone in Pennsylvania could buy for $10,000. And they said it's the average monthly income for 2 months for the average Pennsylvania household. which would be $8,250 total. So I guess $4,125 a month is the average income. It could be 31 weeks of unemployment for a person who's jobless here in the state of Pennsylvania. 14 months of food stamps under the maximum monthly benefit for a family of four. And then it gets a little outrageous. You could get almost 1,600 Pimenti Brothers roast beef and cheese sandwiches. You could get 667 trays of Old Forge pizza from Ravello's. You could get almost a lifetime's worth of season passes to Hershey Park, 74 years worth. And you could get season tickets to the Phillies games, the Sixers games, the Flyers, and the Flyers for two full seasons. So there you go. I mean, you just what one little $10,000 bet would get you. And you look at the just the average person here in the state of Pennsylvania could probably get you about 8 years worth of electric bills. What's going on is we've seen over the last 5 years the cost of electricity skyrocketing. And here in Pennsylvania, one of the higher states around, you look at the deregulation and how wonderful we are. Oh, boy, you got to love that deregulation doing us so well. The article says that households are paying about $1,419 a year for electricity. I go, boy, I wish that were true at my house. But it is the fifth consecutive year that the increase has gone above the inflation rate, according to USA Today in their analysis. They say electricity is consuming a greater share of our after-tax income, more, in fact, at any time since 1996, about a buck and a half out of every $100. So even, you know, when we go out and we buy those fuel efficient, those energy efficient washers and dryers and refrigerators, and you caulk the windows and do all those things, they say that's helped a little bit, but we're using more household devices, we're using more electric devices than ever before. And while prices are climbing, so is our usage. And what I found interesting, New York City had the highest per kilowatt charge, 26 cents, the highest. But the Northwest had, in some areas, had the absolute cheapest at less than 2 cents per kilowatt hour. And you go, well, why is it less than 2 cents? Hydropower dams. They built a bunch of them. Why aren't we talking about doing stuff like that? Because we want nuclear, Rick. We want to build big nuclear plants. Because the industry has they have money. We want to keep burning coal, and we want to keep drilling for oil because we're dependent. We're hooked. They've got us. And we better think about doing something, and something quick. If you remember me talking about this city, this Highland Park, Michigan, that ripped out the electric poles out of their streets. No more streetlights in Highland Park, Michigan, because they can't afford the electric bill. They can't pay the bill, and they sold off the lights to make a couple of bucks. Well, it turns out that New Paris, Ohio, doing the exact same thing. They want to make sure that they can pay their bill, and supposedly it's a Republican area. And some of the people in that area have incomes over $200,000 a year, but got to keep those taxes low. So what I'm hoping to see, because there's part of me that's cruel, part of me that's vindictive, part of me that...
You're wondering if crime will go up.
Yeah, and I hope it's in those good neighborhoods. I hope it's not in the bad neighborhoods. Bad neighborhoods got enough problems. I hope it's in those good neighborhoods. And I always wondered, you know, when I was a kid, our house got robbed all the time. We'd be coming home, opening the front door, and out the back door someone would be going. I swear we got robbed at least 20 times that I can think of. And we didn't have anything. And I always wondered why you didn't just go a couple miles over where the people had something to steal from them. It always made me wonder. A report from Agency France-Presse, again, you know, one of these, high arsenic levels in the water near coal-fired electric plants. Are we surprised? The Environmental Monitor, the Environmental Integrity Project, they've identified 19 new sites across the country where groundwater near coal ash dumps from power plants found to be contaminated with high levels of arsenic. and other pollutants. And again, are you surprised by this? And the answer should be no. But what's going on is we've done so much not to regulate. We've done so much not to keep people with their eye on the ball. I got a friend in West Virginia who talks about the mountaintop removal and these big slurry pits with all this, well, all this waste that's behind dams that they say not if, but when the dam lets loose, all of this stuff is going to wipe, you know, miles out and thousands of people are going to lose their lives. Not if, when. And we're really doing nothing about it. Except the Republicans. The Republicans are working very hard to make sure that our energy needs are met, to make sure that we have a good, clean, safe environment. The Republicans are working very hard. Well, they're working very hard to make sure that we have light bulbs. I don't know if you've seen this story, which has been the big Republican talking point, because Limbaugh is out he's on the beat, because there's evidently a light bulb ban, which again, like most things that Limbaugh or any of the Republicans put out, not true. They have efficiency standards. You can have any light bulb you want. It has to meet a certain efficiency standard. The reality is these manufacturers, they don't want to meet those standards. They're very happy producing the same light bulb that is inefficient, that costs more to operate, but is cheaper for you to buy. They're very happy with that. And as a nation, when you start thinking about energy policy as a nation, because understand, energy to me is a national security issue, why would we be wanting to waste 30% of our electricity, 30% of our energy that goes to lighting by continuing to have these on the market? I know, it's the consumer, right? Consumers should have the option. Not when it's costing us. No, I don't agree with that. But they're doing everything they can possibly do to make sure that we can have the good old incandescent light bulbs that 30% less efficient. You have a bunch of those in your house, Jake?
No.
Did you run out and buy them?
No, actually, believe it or not, I'm up to the modern day light bulb.
Wow, look at you. And the thing
I'm ahead of the curve.
The thing that gets me is, I think it's Sylvania who makes an incandescent bulb that meets the specifications, and it's pretty cheap. But not as cheap as the ones that they can bring in from China. So they're not really advertising it. And I had a friend of mine, a steelworker friend, who was explaining that there's a plant that they make these yep. incandescent bulbs at that are really very good, very energy efficient. But there's a bigger profit margin on the little curly cube light bulbs. So they push those. Because why? More money in it. And again, it shows me that business mentality. And if you were able to do it and you ran the business, you'd say, well, yeah, I'm going to do that too. Which is why I think you need to have rules. You need to have, you need to have rules of the game. Because given their own vices, they're going to feed their own needs. And there's nothing wrong with that until it begins to harm the nation. Which again is one of those moments where you go, how much energy do we need to waste before we do something? Which is why I've been advocating for years to rewire our grid. We should be investing heavily in a 21st century grid that doesn't waste as much power in transmission. I forget what the number was. Somebody told me some astronomical number of the amount of electricity we lose from the time it's produced till the time it gets to your socket. Like 60% of it's lost in transmission between the lines and the plugs and everything. If you remember, Jerry Brown actually ran for president on that, rewiring every house and rewiring the grid to become more energy efficient. But heaven forbid we invest, especially now when we need the jobs. So heaven forbid we invest in upgrading our systems. That would just make sense. And I think Churchill said it best. Americans always do the right thing after trying everything else first. And I think that is a perfect example.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I can ask you a question, Rick, did you get your package yet from your electric company?
No, I didn't. I got
mine today, believe it or not. I got a packet, and in there were four or five companies that I have a choice of signing up.
There you go. Deregulation. Quick break. Right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wednesday was a national day of action protesting a new law that would allow the use of the U.S. military inside the country against U.S. citizens. Occupy Washington, D.C. sat in at U.S. Senator Carl Levin's office to protest the proposed law. Occupy's Kevin Zeese says this radical change in law would allow the use of the U.S. military against protesters and would allow the military to grab citizens off the streets and hold them indefinitely based on mere suspicion of being engaged in hostilities against the U.S. It's a major shift since the U.S. has largely banned the use of the military inside the country against citizens under the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878. The 200 striking IAM members at Wisconsin's Manitowoc Cranes are resisting the company's efforts to destroy union rights. Wisconsin's labor movement says the company is mimicking Scott Walker's attack on public worker collective bargaining. OPEIU Local 9 business rep Dawn Martin.
They should contact Manitowoc Crane and tell them that they should get back to the negotiating table, pull this terrible language off, and this strike is over. I mean, that's all it takes.
Four of the 26 OPEIU workers at Manitowoc Cranes have been laid off due to the strike. OPEIU workers join the IAM picket line when they're off work.
Christmas is coming, and these are families who are doing without, and I can tell you that we are supportive and involved in a food drive and toy drive for the families of the strikers. Any support for them can be done through the Machinist District 10.
A coalition of California education groups is calling budget cuts to education unconscionable. Jesse Russell reports.
At the heart of the discontent is a trigger that would see more than $240 million slashed from home to school transportation. The impact on schools from the cuts will be disproportionate due to a formula based on growth that determines where funding goes. The Los Angeles Unified School District wasted no time in filing a lawsuit to protest the cut because that district would be losing $38.6 million. During a conference call on Wednesday, members of the Education Coalition spoke out against cuts. Classified School Employees Association Executive Director Dave Lowe.
Thousands of children will be forced to walk to school. They'll be walking through dangerous streets and intersections, through neighborhoods with hundreds of registered sexual predators and criminals. This is just completely unconscionable.
California Teachers Association President Dean Vogel said the education system in California is at a crossroads. He said there needs to be revenue.
We believe that California, with the eighth largest economy in the world, sitting right about 46th in per pupil funding, is a disaster waiting to happen. And we've got to wake up, and the policymakers need to wake up.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, for a while there, I was on a rant about this high fructose corn syrup. Basically, you know, it's in absolutely everything that we eat. Then they went through, had this grand transformation. They figured out that people started going, well, what is high fructose corn syrup and why is it in everything? Then they said, well, we need to change our name, rebrand. So now it's corn sugar. And I get to see all these commercials on TV saying, oh, it's corn. It's just like sugar. It's just like sugar. And we've been programmed to think, yeah, just like sugar. Tastes just like sugar. So most of the food we see has been tinkered with a bit or genetically engineered or modified, and we don't seem to think much about it. But if you go over to Europe, they're freaked out about it. And in fact, don't let most of our agriculture in just because of that. So when I see the regulatory body who's supposed to be overseeing this genetic engineering or this modification being pressured, makes me worried. And Mike Ludwig over at truthout.org wrote a great piece, an exclusive piece for Truthout. Under industry pressure, USDA works to speed approval of Monsanto's genetically engineered crops. I got Mike on the line now. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, glad to be back, Rick.
I look at this, and I got to tell you, it scares me. The regulatory people, the people who are supposed to be the cop on the beat, being pressured, being hurried along, not thrilled.
Yeah, you know, the biotech industry works very hard to make sure they can get their crops approved, and sometimes they have to go right to the top in pressuring regulators to make sure that the process of getting their crops approved is streamlined and efficient. And sometimes that comes at the cost of, good quality testing on these very experimental genetically engineered seeds.
You know, I look at some of them, and you think, whenever I hear Monsanto, I think of the Terminator seed, the one you can put in the ground once, and that's it. That's the end of it. You got to buy more. As where, you know, you go back in years past, you could keep using them.
Yeah, I mean, most of these genetically engineered seeds are Terminator seeds. You have to buy new seeds every year, and most farmers are actually under contract. Once you start growing these seeds, you sign a contract with Monsanto or whatever company you bought them from, and you have to, you know, plant their seeds. You can't save the seeds afterward. You have to buy new ones every year, and you're locked into these contracts that have you grow them the way that they specify as genetically engineered products.
You gotta love corporate America and their ever renewed faith in the profit margin. But you wrote this piece, and you're talking about the USDA streamlining their process. Can you talk a little bit about what the streamline of the process to get these genetically engineered crops pushed through? What are they doing?
Well, they're doing two things. They recently announced a new streamlining process, which they've yet to release too many details of. We're waiting for that to hit the Federal Register at any day. But they're also testing out a pilot project. It's called the NEPA pilot project, where they're basically testing, they're doing a 2-year test on a way to make the approval process for genetically engineered crops for seeds and crops that are genetically engineered that are up for approval to be legalized and deregulated. They're testing a new way of making it happen more efficiently and more quickly. And it involves two main points here. And one is that they're training these companies that make the genetically engineered crops to produce their own environmental reports on the crops so that they can more easily provide information to regulators on basically so that these crops can, you know, fit into the environmental guidelines that are under federal law. And they're also testing out cost-sharing agreements where these private companies can help pay private contractors to prepare the legally mandated documents necessary to show that either these crops have an environmental impact or whether they don't.
So basically we're telling them how to get around our rules and telling them exactly what we're looking for so that they can skirt the rules a little bit.
Well, you know, the regulators still can independently review all the information that the companies provide them. But, you know, if you talk to any activist who's critical of our regulatory system, they'll say that all the information that the companies provide them is biased because they're not concerned about environmental impacts of their products. They're concerned about profit, and they're concerned about getting their products approved as quickly as possible so they can sell them on the market. So, you know, if you ask Monsanto if their new genetically engineered seed has an environmental impact, I guess you trust them to tell you the truth?
I don't know. And then you look at the pharmaceutical companies have been doing kind of the same thing for years with their rush to get the FDA to approve their drugs so they can get it to the market. And every so often we keep hearing, hey, have you taken this drug and do you have this list of side effects? Because much like you're laying out here, they didn't do the due diligence at the beginning.
Right, you know, and we could wish that the United States Department of Agriculture had more funding to do their own tests, but they're increasingly relying more and more on information that's provided by the industry itself, and also by these outside private contractors. You know, I was talking to one activist who said there's basically a cottage industry of these contractors who make money creating these environmental reviews, and he's looked through some of the work that they've done, and some of them, you know, aren't even qualified. Some of the people they have doing the research aren't even qualified to be doing the research in the areas that they're supposed to. You know, if someone might have a degree in fisheries who is doing research on a genetically engineered seed.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Mike Ludwig. He's got a piece over at truthout.org on the USDA being pressured to approve Monsanto's genetically engineered crops. You know, and at the beginning I talked about the EU, and so most of our crops are banned there because of this genetic modification. In this process, I think we're kind of closing that market to ourselves because of this.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's actually what a lot of the biotech companies argued when they were behind closed doors pressuring regulators to speed up the approval process and also to do the minimum environmental review of these crops. If we were doing, you know, if we were doing in-depth reviews of these seeds when they're up for approval, it might send a signal to other countries that we think they're unsafe. Well, it turns out these other countries already think they're unsafe and taking a much more cautious approach. I mean, earlier this year, Hungary went as far as destroying 1,000 acres of Monsanto corn, just flat out getting it out of their country. You know, in Europe, there's a lot more skepticism. There's also a lot more independent scientists involved in the process. We don't see that as often in our regulatory process here in the United States. And that's one of the reasons why a vast majority of now our corn and our soy and our cotton is now genetically engineered. And it's posing a trade problem for us because now a lot of our exports are genetically engineered. And if other countries don't want to accept these crops that we're now relying on as a base for our agriculture, it can affect American farmers. It can affect the American economy. And when the biotech industry was pressuring the USDA to speed up this approval process, that's something they brought up. They didn't say, hey, let's have the most, you know, safe and in-depth reviews of these crops. They said, hey, if we send a bad message to other countries, it could affect the American economy. And the USDA was listening. You've got to wonder, what is the priority here? Is it a priority the safety of our food, the safety of our agriculture, or is it
the safety of their profit? Yeah.
Right.
And I got to ask that question because, you know, you look at these genetically modified crops and you look at a lot of this stuff, and I go back to the high fructose corn syrup, which, you know, I've read some reports that they're trying to link it to the obesity problem in this country because our body just doesn't digest it the same.
Yeah, you know, and with the rise of genetically engineered corn, I mean, corn syrup is something that is a more popular filler now in a lot of our foods. And, you know, in the United States, it's accepted that eating genetically engineered foods is the same as eating conventionally grown foods or organic foods in a lot of ways. But scientists in Europe don't exactly agree, and they have conflicting studies. And it really comes down to who you talk to of what is healthy and what isn't healthy.
But is it accepted here, or is it we don't know? Because, you know, you talk to most people. I don't think the majority of people know where their food comes from or if it's been modified or not.
Well, you know, when the USDA deregulates a crop or considers a crop for deregulation, they do not consider its health impacts on humans. They actually only consider whether or not it poses and I'm quoting here, a plant pest risk, which has nothing to do with what the crop does to you or what the food does to you once you eat it. They don't even consider that when they're deregulating these crops. That doesn't even play into the process. And, you know, a lot of scientists in the United States disagree on whether, you know, having genetically engineered foods in your body makes a difference. It's actually very hard to get information about this because so many people disagree. That's why it's very new. We've only been growing these things for 10 years, and a lot of it is still up in the air and up for debate. However, within our regulatory system, it looks almost like a rubber stamp. You know, we approve them as they come because it's become such a part of our mainstream agriculture.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I feel so happy and so self-assured, so assured that I'm a human guinea pig for the Monsantos and the Archer Daniels Midlands and the BASS of the world.
Right, yeah. And, you know, and I want to point out that a big part of the story was actually a Freedom of Information Act request that I filed with the USDA to find out what kind of things was happening behind closed doors with the industry. And I got several letters between top USDA officials and the biotech industry, and none of that came up. Human health was never discussed. It was all, are we going to be able to compete with Brazil and China, who is also approving a lot of genetically engineered crops? Are we going to be able to maintain dominance in the agricultural market in the world? And it was all about money, and it wasn't about health of the land or health of consumers. And that was what was being discussed here. And that is why the USDA started initiating a reorganization of their regulators and initiating this new pilot project. Because after a couple lawsuits filed by activists who were concerned about these issues stalled the approvals of several crops, there was kind of a backlog in the USDA, and that really angered the industry. So they sent several angry letters to top officials asking, you know, let's speed up this process. Let's figure out a way to get around these things. Let's create environmentally defensible documents so we can avoid these lawsuits in the future. It's basically a way of saying let's have less oversight and less input from consumers and farmers.
Yeah, this does not give me confidence in our USDA, and especially when you look at the fact that, you know, thanks to the WTO, we don't get to know where our meat comes from either. So now I've got genetically modified crops that I may not know are modified or not, and meat probably from Mexico that I am not allowed to know where it's from. I got to tell you, our food supply is really screwed up.
Right, and we have to ask ourselves, you know, who's going to make the choice? Are we going to rely on regulators? Are we going to rely on ourselves? Unfortunately, I know that a lot of organic foods out there, which are the alternative to genetically engineered crops and crops that are sprayed with a lot of herbicides and pesticides, are much more expensive. You know, I'm wondering that it's really a struggle for the American consumer here. You can vote with your dollar, but sometimes it's very expensive, especially for working people.
Right. I mean, how do you know that what you're buying is actually organic, and how do you know what's what?
Yeah, I mean, it's been streamlined the politics of this go on forever, and farmers are always disagreeing with themselves and disagreeing with each other. A lot of times when it ends up in Washington, it's hard to get everyone's voices heard.
Yeah, because in Washington, it's all about the profit. Is there anywhere to go for good information, or are we're just kind of screwed in all this?
Well, you know, there's a lot of independent researchers in Europe who have done a lot of work independent of the industry, and they've released studies that are much more alarming than some of the things we see here. And a lot of the universities here, you know, I mean, we also have to realize that our agricultural system here now is relying on genetically engineered crops. It's hard to get good information because it's become systemic here in the United States.
Right.
You know, I would look to Europe, and I would look to South America, where there's been some rogue scientists who've come out with studies that don't exactly match up with some of the information you get here, but you really have to sometimes look outside of the United States where we're not so entrenched in genetically engineered farming.
Yes. Scary stuff to me, man. I'll tell you, I'm not happy to see this direction that we're heading at all. The piece, again, is Under Industry Pressure, USDA Works to Speed Approval of Monsanto's Genetically Engineered Crops, written by Mike Ludwig over at truthout.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Mike, always great to talk with you. You guys do great work over there at Truthout. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, Rick.
All right. Gonna take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think? Back after this.
Rick Smith.
Great news, people. A hot spot of non-spotted ladybugs has been spotted in Amagansett, New York. This uplifting story is a rich organic mixture of state pride, nature's resilience, America's scientific pluck, teamwork, serendipity, and bug love. In today's hard times, we need this. Let's start with the bug. This ladybug is the classic Cochinellidae beetle with exactly 9 black spots on its red back. A benevolent and delightful creature, it's beloved by everyone from children to farmers. So beloved that it is the official insect of New York State. Sadly, and somewhat embarrassingly, however, this state official has bugged out of the state. The last recorded sighting of this ladybug species in New York was 29 years ago. Apparently a victim of competition from imported Asian and European ladybug species, as well as pesticides and the loss of habitat, only 90 of the native 9 spotteds have been seen in all of North America in the past decade. But since 2000, a team of diligent Cornell University entomologists and volunteers have kept up the search through Cornell's Lost Ladybug Project. The searchers persisted, even when New York's legislators tried in 2006 to abandon the bug that seemingly had abandoned the state. Luckily, though, legislative inertia killed that effort to replace the state insect, and the Ladybug Project kept faith and kept looking. Then, this summer, lo and behold, a volunteer spotted one sitting pretty as you please in a patch of sunflowers on an organic farm in Amagansett. About 20 more were subsequently found on the farm amidst rows of carrots, beans, and flowers, enough for the project to establish a reproducing colony, while also building confidence that more will be discovered. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep up with this bit of good bug news, go to lostladybug.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.com.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Listener sent me this this story from Yahoo. Somebody just wrote in and said, you know, hey, I got myself $80,000 in the debt. And his point was, look, you know, this is simple stuff. This is a guy who went to college. This is a guy who did what he was supposed to do. And yet he's still pulling the Horatio Alger bit that I should have pulled myself up by my bootstraps. He says, look, you know, from, you know, these couple of years to this couple of years, went to college, got my bachelor's degree, went on, got my master's degree, did work study, worked 20 hours a week, but I was only making $6.25 an hour, $125 a week, and I used that to live off of. What I should have done is I should have taken a part-time job and worked 10 or 20 hours more at $8 or $9 an hour, and I could have had more money. Could have paid off my debt. And I'm going, but what about school? So if you work those extra 10, 20 hours, what about the reason that you're taking out all these loans? Doesn't that suffer? By the time he got out of college, he racked up about $8,000 to $10,000 worth of credit card bills, because after all, you do need books, you need clothes, you need gas in the car, you need all that stuff that, you know, hey, you got to live. So he racked up $8,000 to $10,000 there, and then he says, I racked up medical bills. Because, you know, as a young guy going into the job market, changing jobs every year or two, you have that gap in coverage. And he said, you know, I incurred about $10,000 worth of medical bills. So there, $80,000. He says, you know, I've been paying since 2003, diligently making overpayments, and, you know, still $70,000 in debt. And you go, all for an education. And, you know, and I wonder what he does for a living, because I don't know if $80,000 is worth an education. And you see what's going on in the UK. They actually have an organization, and I can't imagine it being here, but they have the English Collective of Prostitutes, the ECP. Yes, they have kind of a prostitutes union, who they're saying, now that they've had this downturn, now that they've gone to cut, gut, and punish over there, what they're finding is they're finding a lot of desperate British students who have massive rising debt. They're seeing cuts in their fund, in their school funding. They're seeing cuts in their support. There are no more jobs. So they're turning to, guess what? Turning to prostitution. And I go, you know, is that where we're going here? I mean, is that the whole point of the conservative ideology? I mean, because if really, honestly, truthfully, there are a number of them over there that, you know, have partaken. You know, here occasionally on the program, we talk about one or two of them who have, you know, the good family man, God-fearing Christian, who just got caught with that. Well, I was just giving her a ride home. I was going to counsel her with my hand up her skirt, but I was counseling her. We were talking about Jesus while we were naked in the hotel room. You know, it is what it is, but, you know, that's what they try and say. But is that where we're heading? Are we heading to the world like this? I mean, they have seen the numbers of prostitutes double in the last year. Because you got these college kids who are going, I got to make ends meet. I got to live that dream. I got to get the education so I can get the job. Because without the education, nobody's hiring. And you look at the numbers that are just the debt numbers are just completely out of bounds. I mean, if I were an 18, 20-year-old kid right now, I think the last thing I'd be doing is considering going to college just because I can't afford it. And then you end up in some crappy job that pays nothing. And you look at some of the most dangerous, low-paying jobs in the country. And, you know, they're saying, you know what, you got all these low-paying jobs, under $40,000 a year, people working 40, 50, 60 hours a week. For what? Well, trying to make ends meet. You look at these first-line supervisors that work at these retail places. A lot of them, according to this survey, work about 128 hours per year more than every other worker. And yet they make $36,000 a year. And you go, really? Is that a good thing? Automotive parts salesmen, they work 101 hours a year more than the average. They make $32,000. Heavy truck drivers, you know, people, tractor trailer drivers, 193 more hours a year than the average, and they make only $38,000 a year. You look at farm equipment mechanics, they work on average 165 hours more for $38,000 a year. And you go, really? That seems like an awful lot of money for, awful lot of time for such little money. And I gotta be honest, I look at the truck driver thing, 193 hours a year more than the average. I think that's really low. Because you think about the average truck driver puts in 60 to 70, and the honest ones who will show you both books working 80 and 100 hours a week. So you kind of got to go 193 a year, somebody's padding their books, because that seems awful low to me.
That's a little bit less than 4 hours a week extra. That's awfully low.
But here again, the CEO pay, man, going up, 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 and up. That one guy, $145 million for 1 year, going to pay 15% tax. That truck driver, working 193 extra hours the year of what he, I guess, I don't believe it, but he's saying that, $38,000 a year. There's a weight thing here, that, you know, there's a fairness thing, you know, that scale thing, just not doing it for me. I know that CEO, he works long hours, he's under a lot of stress. For $145 million, I think I'd be under a little stress too. The stress of, oh my God, where am I going to put my money? And you wonder why people in this country look at these big executives, and they look at Wall Street and say, you know what? Too much power in the hands of these people. Too much control. Too much. We need something, someone. We need an entity. Make one up who's going to rein this in. And to me, there's only really one major entity, and that's government. And I say the government should, as we have done in the past, encourage people to join and form labor unions, so that $145 million, you go to, imagine going to the bargaining table. The CEO is sitting across the table and got all his minions. He made $145 million. He's going to bicker with you over a nickel an hour? Really? $145 million in his pocket, and he's going to dicker over a nickel. And the truth of the matter is, he probably would. And he'd probably ask for money back because he's got to pay for himself. And I look at this. How many people have heard of Cooper Tire and Rubber? If you remember, back a year and a half, 2 years ago, the U.S. steelworkers filed a WTO case, a 301 case, with the WTO, charging that the Chinese had injured the tire industry in the U.S. by dumping. There was a tariff put on. And amazingly, the American tire companies, like Cooper Tire, actually fought against the steelworkers. Didn't want the steelworkers to protect them. Why? They were quite happy moving jobs overseas. And then they could ship their tires back here, make them much cheaper over there, and sell them for the same price here. And guess what? More profit. Well, back on November 28th of this year, Cooper Tire and Rubber as a thank you. Really, I think as a gesture of thanks to the workers who made them money here in the U.S. in their Findlay, Ohio plant. As a gesture of thanks, they locked out all 1,050 of them. Told them, sorry, we don't need you. There's the door. We're not agreeing to anything. Gather the sheep, get the flock out. We're bringing in, oh, and I love this, a crew of out-of-state, inexperienced, temporary replacement workers. And that's the union's words right there, a crew of out-of-state, inexperienced, temporary replacement workers. I would expect scab, because that's who they are. No good, snake in the grass, scabs. And you look at this and you go, this is what's happened in this country. And the right-wingers are foaming at the mouth that the NLRB would stick up for workers, yet when these companies kick the workers to the curb, which is happening more and more and more, there aren't any strikes. There are lockouts now. Our Republican friends have nothing. Well, that's just how things work. Again, more scabs. So I say we use the good old-fashioned language. Take it back to where it belongs. Let's take a quick break right back after this. We're going to come back with Ted Martin from EqualityPA.org. Stick around.
90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Only 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. A living wage, health benefits, safe working conditions, these aren't privileges to be taken away, they're rights to be protected. This is Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Public services and workers' rights are under attack like never before. But the Main Street movement is pulling together. Nurses, firefighters, cops, teachers, students, and neighbors, ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Coming after workers and their unions, it's a shameful agenda for Wall Street politicians, but AFSCME's been in this fight for 75 years. We're not about to stop now. Join the Main Street movement at AFSCME13.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so, but now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now, and this credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to PSECU.com/be free and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So again, you know, you look at the Snow White and the other seven dwarfs, and you got to wonder if they just like ticking people off or if they're just plain stupid. And I look at Romney, who used to be in favor of civil unions, and then he said, well, you know, I'm not, then he was, and now he's come up with, a third class where he's going to propose an amendment so that marriage is one man, one woman, and people who were already married can stay married. And it's really kind of bizarre watching these people twist themselves and contort when they truly believe in equality, but they have to pander to people who are just brain dead. And that's what I see. And you don't see it on the federal level. At the federal level, there has to be something that takes control. Or if not the state level. But sadly, it doesn't. So that's why you have to fight on the local level. And here in Pennsylvania, there have been a number of municipalities across the state who have passed non-discrimination ordinances. This year alone, several local boroughs and townships have done that. And here to talk about that is Ted Martin. He's with EqualityPA.org, EqualityPA.org, the website. We got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Ted, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks for having me on, Rick. I always appreciate the time to be on your show, and I'm happy to be with you this evening.
Thanks so much. You know, I look at this, and there's just a part of me that goes, why can't we stop talking about this already and just give people the same rights that everybody else has and move on to what I think is important, jobs?
Well, I think you're exactly correct. I mean, you know, the state legislature has been dealing with this issue for over a decade now. And really what's happening across the state and what's happening in the phone calls that I get every day are just average people who learn that it's still perfectly legal in the vast majority of Pennsylvania to fire someone for being gay. And, you know, they're offended by this. And so they hear these local municipalities passing an ordinance, and they want to work with us on how to do it in their own community. And so in the past year alone, we've helped to pass seven ordinances, the most recent being Susquehanna Township here in central Pennsylvania. And I'm dealing with over a dozen communities across the state who want to do these, you know, in the coming months. And I think the bottom line on so much of this is that people are simply offended. And, you know, if you want to talk about building a workforce, if you want to talk about having stronger jobs, if you want to talk about people who are more comfortable in what they do, then, you know, you really have to make sure that they are not going to be fired randomly for being who they are. I mean, obviously, you know, someone who is comfortable in their job and knows that they are respected and protected can do a whole lot of things, like produce better, like help to organize, like, you know, help their fellow workers. And I think that, you know, that's really the key. It's really the key, and that's what we've been seeing in so much of what we've been doing. You know, people are just circumventing the state because they know things really aren't happening there, and they're taking it into their own hands in the grassroots, and that's really where the movement is right now.
And I think it's important to explain. I mean, you know, as I see it, I don't think that I should have any more rights than you have. I think that Constitution thing that talks about equal rights under the law, equal protection, I think that should apply. And even if I'm not comfortable with whatever it is you do in your life, none of my business.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you're correct. I mean, you know, we have poll. Equality Pennsylvania has done poll after poll after poll, three in a row over the past 5 years, and each of the polls have shown that Pennsylvanians overwhelmingly, men, women, older, younger, Westerners, Easterners, Democrats, Republicans, all by a 2-to-1 margin across the state, 70% is about an average, say that they feel that it should be against the law to fire someone for being gay. It should be against the law to evict someone from their apartment or deny them a public accommodation like a public bathroom. And the thing is, you know, once again, this is just something that is pretty ingrained. And I really do feel that I have some faith in my fellow Pennsylvanians and that they're pretty fair. And I think that, you know, most people say, maybe perhaps I don't agree or maybe I don't understand or fully comprehend everything, but I don't think you should lose your job for it.
Right.
And, you know, and I think that that's just so basic and fundamental. And I think that people need to understand if you are comfortable in your work, you produce better for the entire community. And that's just really fundamental.
Let me ask you this, Ted. You know, how much of this debate do you think is about marriage is BS? Because I got to be honest, there's to me this whole marriage debate seems kind of disingenuous. To me, it seems more about money. It seems more about denying you the right to health care, denying you the right to some of the tax benefits and some of the other things that come along with marriage. I'm curious what your thought on that is.
Well, I think that, you know, I think it's so much of the argument that is put forth on this issue in general. And, you know, and let me just back up. I mean, in Pennsylvania, the LGBT community, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, there are so few protections. There are really so few, you know, overall protections, against hate crimes and bullying and all these things in Pennsylvania. And, you know, whenever there's a discussion, whenever the discussion is about anything proactive for the community, what happens is that the marriage issue comes up. And obviously marriage is an emotional central part of the argument that we all make. However, the opposition uses it really as a way to sort of confuse people. And it's really mean-spirited and it's horribly unfair, the way they use it, but they really use it in the emotional white dress church sort of way. And what they do is that they confuse the people that are making the decisions and the public so that no decision can ever be made. And so, you know, marriage in this instance, you know, which is really about protection, it's really about the ability for people to, you know, live a life in a relationship and be comfortable, it becomes almost used as a weapon. And that's really the unfortunate part of how things are, you know, where it's come to a pass in Pennsylvania. You know, I really try to make the case when talking to you or talking to anyone else or a legislator or the public about the whole picture. I mean, I think the whole picture in Pennsylvania means marriage absolutely is important. But, you know, when you can still be fired, you know, we can still be denied a public accommodation. I think the picture in Pennsylvania is much broader. And so marriage, I think, it's certainly a part of it, but it's not the predominating part of it. And I think it is, you know, ridiculous. And just to remind you, 2 days ago, the Muhlenberg College poll came out, the third poll in a row showing 52% support across Pennsylvania, 52% support of legalizing or recognizing gay marriage. And they actually use those terms, recognizing gay marriage. They didn't use any euphemisms. And 57% of the people in the poll said that they would be against any attempt to amend the Pennsylvania Constitution to prohibit same-sex marriage. And the most telling number, the most remarkably telling number in that entire poll, 62% of the people polled said it had absolutely no bearing on how they would choose a candidate if a candidate supported gay marriage.
That has nothing to do. I got to be honest. It kind of does to me. You know, I look at some of these Republicans who foam at the mouth over. I look at Rick Santorum, which is kind of funny. That's a whole other discussion. But I look at him, and there's no way I could possibly vote for him, not just on that issue, but on a whole plethora of other ones. Partially because of that.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me. I always say, you know, I was married in California, and I always say, you know, if my marriage is a threat, if, you know, because I'm married to a man, if that's a threat to your marriage, that deeper problem, far deeper problems in your marriage.
Yeah, I tell the story all the time of a guy I used to work with. I drove a truck for a living for many years, and we used to go up into Massachusetts and spend the night in a hotel, and he would meet his girlfriend at the hotel. They would go back to her apartment with their child, and then on the way back, he'd go to home to his wife and two kids. And gay marriage was going to ruin the sanctity of his marriage.
Well, you know, maybe things have changed. Maybe he signed like an anti-adultery pledge. You know, maybe he's gotten a light, and you know, now he's signed on the dotted line.
That's good. So again, you know, back to this idea that on the local level we can affect change. You know, what can we do to push this forward to make, you know, the state wake up, but to do it on a local level?
Well, I think, you know, really what we need to do is keep it moving everywhere in the state. I mean, you know, and I think it's happening everywhere. It's happening in central Pennsylvania. There's discussions in the Lehigh Valley. There's discussions in the southeast. There's discussions in the west. I think it just needs to keep moving. And, you know, I think people need to, You know, go to our website, find out whether or not your community is currently covered, one of the 26 municipalities that are covered. And I think that, you know, by knowing this and by seeing this and understanding this, then you start to talk to the people you've elected, you know, the people that you've elected to your city council, your borough council, who are, believe me, incredibly accessible. You know that. I mean, these are part-time people that, yep. you know, your dry cleaner, your neighbor, and you start talking to them, and you really start talking to them about, you know, moving this forward. And I guarantee you the education that you will give to these people will astound them and will make it easier to do. And that's the way to do it. I think that is really and truly the way to do it. We're always happy. Equality Pennsylvania is always happy to work with communities, always happy to do that. But it needs to be the people in the communities moving things forward.
Yeah, I agree. Last question I've got for you, Ted Martin. Again, the website, equalitypa.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. You know, I'm always amazed when I hear stories of discrimination because, to be honest, I don't in my life ever think that I've ever really been discriminated against. Has it ever really happened to you that you've gone to a hotel or somewhere and they've denied you the ability to stay there?
Well, you know, it's never happened to me. I can mercifully say it has never happened to me. However, you know, I receive on average anywhere from 2 to 4 calls a month from all over the state, people who have been denied certain things in work situations, people who have been asked to leave businesses. It's not floods, I will say that, but I do get, you know, at least, like I said, two to four calls a month, which is probably 2 to 4 calls too many. And that's what we know of. You know, discrimination is a hard thing. People don't like to admit it. It sometimes makes it worse. It's embarrassing.
Humiliating,
it's
sure.
Fired. Yeah. So I think, you know, things are certainly out there. It is the second highest, reported statistic for the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. Even though it's not protected under state law, they keep statistics. It's the highest number. Discrimination based on sexual orientation is the second most reported case. So it is certainly out there.
Yeah, I go back to what my grandfather always said: "Don't worry about me, worry about yourself." And basically saying, you know, hey, as long as you're acting within the law, I don't care what you do. As long as it doesn't affect me, God bless you. Live your life. And that's kind of what the country was founded on. You have the freedom to do whatever it is you want to do until your rights infringe upon mine. And, you know, that's pretty much where it lies for me.
Absolutely. And I agree.
Ted Martin, always great talking with you. I appreciate it. EqualityPA.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much, Ted.
Thank you, Rick. Have a good evening.
All right. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Living is precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times. But without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-8255. 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Or check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comments, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Best way to get a hold of me. Also, you can call us here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Today in labor history, the AFL, the American Federation of Labor Convention, passed a 1 cent per capita assessment to organize working women. The date? Today, 1913. So again, you know, even before they could vote, people, the labor movement was going, how do we get fairness? How do we get equality for women? And, you know, I talked to Ted, and you go, how do you get equality and fairness for those folks as well? We shouldn't be discriminating against anybody. Also on this day in history, 1921 was the year, mothers, daughters, all across Kansas, took to the strike line because their husbands had gone on strike, while the National Guard today came out and, well, had to smack them in the line. The New York Times headline called the women Amazon Army after all of these women took to the streets to protect their incomes. Look, these women, they were dependent. Their children, they were dependent. They needed the money that these miners used to make, and the coal barons of the time, can't do it. Sorry, you're going to starve. Also, on this day in labor history, 1941, the AFL pledges there will be no strikes after 8 days after Pearl Harbor for the duration of World War II. And also today in labor history, the U.S. Age Discrimination Employment Act became law. So, again, you look at all of this stuff. Throughout time, we've made progress. We've stopped discriminating against people. Women, African Americans, old people. It's only a matter of time. So homophobes, it's only a matter of time. So probably not a bad idea to get over it. Just a thought. Anyway, big news today. It has become apparent that the Gingrich man has signed another pledge. The Personhood USA group has asked him to sign another pledge, declaring that he would support a human life amendment to the Constitution and endorse legislation to make clear the 14th Amendment protects the unborn. And, of course, Nudie signed right onto that. And again, you know, I kind of just, you know, scratched my head because he said that he would be in favor of, well, making post-contraception birth control illegal. So that means the plan B. I got to go, you know, at some point, how do you know contraception happened? Because the plan B is supposed to be taken like anywhere from, you know, just after to 48 hours to make sure that it doesn't happen. Would that then be illegal? Would IUDs be illegal? And then, because I've been saying this for the longest time, the whole goal in all of this, these pledges and all of this discussion is making birth control illegal. They don't care about Roe versus Wade. They care about Griswold. They want to go back and undo a married couple's right to have any type of birth control whatsoever. In fact, they may even put a cop in your bedroom where you can't even practice the rhythm method. No rhythm for you. Stay in there. Get the job done. That's the American way. Am I wrong? I mean, it's what it seems like to me. They just seem to be so preoccupied with what people do in the confines of their four walls. Why weren't they that concerned with Jerry Sandusky? I mean, really. I mean, I don't care what Ted Martin does. He's a married guy. God bless him. Hope he's happy.
Well, with Newt, I mean, come on. You and I know the man will say and do anything to get elected. He'll put his
much like Romney.
He'll put his finger up to the wind, and you know what's the issue this week? Well, whatever my conservative friends want, that's the position I'm taking.
Yeah, well, speaking about putting your finger up to the wind, Mitt Romney's had some. He's trying so hard to be, you know, one of the guys. He's trying to get that Bush quality, because the one thing you could say about Bush is that you could see him sitting at a bar. And I'm sure for a long time he did a lot of that.
By all accounts, he did an awful lot of that, and that's not the only thing he did at the bar.
No, I mean
he was a good dancer.
He used to sit at the glass at the mirrored table, and well, that's a whole.
Well, thing. By all accounts, he danced on the top of the bar a couple times, but you know, hey, we all do stupid things when we're young.
I'm not going there. So anyway, Mitt's trying to be like one of us, trying to be one of the guys, and you got to love some of the things that have come out of his mouth. Rick Perry loves to say, I don't know why I said eight. I don't know why I said there are only eight Supreme Court judges. I know there's nine. sometimes it just falls out of my mouth. So you got to wonder what else is going to fall out of his mouth. Maybe Ted would know. So Romney has said some really dumb things, especially like the fact when he said when he's in sync with the Tea Party. Remember that? I'm in sync with the Tea Party. I'm the Tea Party guy. He also said that he'd like to repeal Wall Street reform because that's really in sync with the rest of us. Because we really, I know all of my friends, they wake up in the morning and go, boy, I got to tell you, if I could just repeal that Wall Street reform, I'm sure my employer would give me a nickel an hour raise. I love what he said back in August that his beachfront house wasn't being quadrupled. It was just being doubled in size. So it's not growing by, it's doubling, that's all. Didn't your house double last year? Come on. On the foreclosure crisis, being one of us, of course, because, he's one of us. He's one of the guys. He said of foreclosures, he said, let it hit the bottom. Let it hit the bottom. Let it bottom out. Then we can go from there. And when he was asked about gas being $3.45 a gallon, he said, that's a good price. How many middle-class people, raise your hands, how many middle-class people think $3.45 for a gallon of gas is a good price? Especially when, as a nation, we're a net exporter of energy. We're shipping gas out of the country. Is that a good thing? Oh, man.
Kind of makes you wonder about this law they keep telling us, of law of supply and demand.
Yeah, well, it only matters for you and me, not for them.
Must be a different law.
Yeah, only for you and me. Romney also claimed that federal workers make more money than he does. I'm sorry. Are you talking wages? Because, yeah, that's true. The federal workers earn more money than he does in wages. That means they traded their time for wages. Now, if you're going to talk about that money that he gets from stocks, that money that he gets from investments, where he says that he pays no taxes at all.
I'll mention one more. The speaker is, I think everybody, by the way, I'm trying to think if there's anyone on the stage besides me that hasn't adopted the idea that there should be no tax on interest, dividends, and capital gains. My own calculation is that if that were the case, for anybody, no tax on interest, dividends, and capital gains, I would have paid no taxes in the last 10 years. Because all my income is from interest, dividends, and capital gains.
So I think he's pretty honest about that. Middle-class guy, one of us, right? Because you get most of your stuff from there. Absolutely. When I look at this guy, he's not one of us. He also said he wrote a piece called Let Detroit Go Bankrupt, good middle-class idea, claimed corporations are people, and, you know, that $10,000 bet. Can't get away from that. I'll tell you, good old Mitzi, Mitzi, Mitzi. And again, he's working so hard to be one of us. He claimed at one point he was unemployed. Were you collecting unemployment there, Mitt? Were you subject to a drug test? And the answer is no. And what's frustrating to me is people are, I think there's some, I'm hoping there's nobody buying this load of malarkey. But there may be. They're absolutely made.
Did you catch it when he was trying to explain how he experienced being just an average guy when he was in France? Did you catch that? Where he lived in a house where they didn't have any running water and they didn't even have accommodations to go to the bathroom. Boy, if that doesn't make Newt one of us, what does?
1-888-520 Rick, right back after this. Stick around.
America. Rick Smith. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wednesday was a national day of action protesting a new law that would allow the use of the U.S. military inside the country against U.S. citizens. Occupy Washington, D.C. sat in at U.S. Senator Carl Levin's office to protest the proposed law. Occupy's Kevin Zeese says this radical change in law would allow the use of the U.S. military against protesters and would allow the military to grab citizens off the streets and hold them indefinitely based on mere suspicion of being engaged in hostilities against the U.S. It's a major shift since the U.S. has largely banned the use of the military inside the country against citizens under the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878. The 200 striking IAM members at Wisconsin's Manitowoc Cranes are resisting the company's efforts to destroy union rights. Wisconsin's labor movement says the company is mimicking Scott Walker's attack on public worker collective bargaining. OPEIU Local 9 business rep Dawn Martin.
They should contact Manitowoc Cranes and tell them that they should get back to the negotiating table, pull this terrible language off, and this strike is over. I mean, that's all it takes.
Four of the 26 OPEIU workers at Manitowoc Cranes have been laid off due to the strike. OPEIU workers join the IAM picket line when they're off work.
Christmas is coming, and these are families who are doing without, and I can tell you that we are supportive and involved in a food drive and toy drive for the families of the strikers. Any support for them can be done through the Machinist District 10.
A coalition of California education groups is calling budget cuts to education unconscionable. Jesse Russell reports.
At the heart of the discontent is a trigger that would see more than $240 million slashed from home-to-school transportation. The impact on schools from the cuts will be disproportionate due to a formula based on growth that determines where funding goes. The Los Angeles Unified School District wasted no time in filing a lawsuit to protest the cut because that district would be losing $38.6 million. During a conference call on Wednesday, members of the Education Coalition spoke out against cuts. Classified School Employees Association Executive Director Dave Lowe.
Thousands of children will be forced to walk to school. They'll be walking through dangerous streets and intersections, through neighborhoods with hundreds of registered sexual predators and criminals. This is just completely unconscionable.
California Teachers Association President Dean Vogel said the education system in California is at a crossroads. He said there needs to be revenue.
We believe that California, with the eighth largest economy in the world, sitting right about 46th in per pupil funding, is a disaster waiting to happen. And we've got to wake up, and the policymakers need to wake up.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Bound to lose unless you're one of the Waltons, one of the six heirs to the Walton fortune. And you look at the folks over at the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics. They're saying in 2007, those six sperm lottery winners, the Waltons there, they had a combined net worth greater than the bottom 30% of the people in this nation, some 90 million people. And what they're saying is when the new numbers come out, that 30% number probably going to be dwarfed. You're looking at six people with greater wealth than 90 million. And you look at the Forbes 400, it's been widely reported they control half of the nation's wealth, more than 150 million people. And you hear the right talking about, well, you're worried about redistribution of wealth. Yeah, I kind of am. Because it's been distributed, I think, in an inefficient way and in a way that's harmful for this nation. Because you look at what the Waltons have been around, what they've been doing. Lobbying for policies to destroy the estate tax, to destroy regulations, so they do better. And if you give them that kind of money, what do you expect? And look what they've done around the world. That's why I've asked Philip Jennings. He's the General Secretary of UNI Global Union in New York for the UN Global Compact Board meeting. Mr. Jennings, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Rick.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. It's a sad state of affairs this global economy has brought us all into, to be fair. This is not just a U.S. story. It's the picture that you've just painted can be applied to nations around the world. We have the social contract is broken, Rick, and it's the business model of Walmart that has driven us to this sad state of affairs of growing unemployment and increased inequality.
Do you think it's Walmart specific, or is it this idea that we need to be more business friendly and we need to pursue policies that business will give us jobs, this concept of the benevolent corporation who gives us all these wonderful things?
You have the most business friendly environment on the planet here in the United States of America. You've got a bigger private sector than anybody else. You've got a benign regulatory regime. You've got a very benign, what we can call, taxation policy. This country has never been a better place to do business. So that's the lobby talk of the business interests down in K Street in Washington, D.C. Get the message. You have the most positive business environment that there is. Unfortunately, it ain't working for the majority of people.
But what they keep telling us is if we just deregulate more and lower taxes, this confidence fairy will come back and regain, everybody will be confident again and the economy will be smoking.
No. The business community is already sitting on a massive sums of capital, which they should be putting to work. And they don't know when to realize that they've won, and what they're doing is creating tremendous damage for the rest of society. What we're seeing here, I think, is unsustainable. And the business community has to look at itself once again and realize that they are part of a community. They are part of the community of the United States of America, and continuing on this path will not bring sustainable wealth. You have, and they have, a problem of demand.
Yep.
There is nothing in the workers' pocket left to spend. They tried the debt path. It brought financial calamity. And we have a level of inequality in this country which I think is unsustainable.
Yep.
You have the same distribution of wealth today as you had in the late 1920s. And look where that took the world.
Yeah,
the business community is doing well in this country. And I'm not sure what else is left to deregulate. Are they serious about deregulating Wall Street? After the financial calamities that we've seen, the lessons have not been learned, Rick. The lessons have not been learned.
And I would argue that that's on the global level as well. I mean, all across the globe, you've seen this wealth inequality. You've seen the divide of the haves and the have-nots. And I think it's because we've allowed the few to control so much.
The few have got enormous wealth at their disposal, and it's built in the United States on a business model which says, keep the unions out, and to basically stop the ability of people to negotiate a fair contract and a fair deal. And this is where Walmart comes back in. All roads lead back to Walmart. The
right.
Walmart wealth of the rich six, as you referred to them, is built on a business model in this country to keep the union movement out at all costs. When you keep the movement out, you don't get the opportunity to negotiate. If you keep the movement out, you don't get a proper opportunity to have a fairer distribution of the economic pie. So when Walmart wins its union-busting game, aided by their friends in Washington, then this is a model which gets replicated. And when for a while, Walmart was seen as the model to emulate. And it leads to a situation where you see these horrendous unfairnesses in the distribution of wealth. This country needs to rebuild its labor movement, to put a legislative process in place to enable people to organize and to negotiate, And that's the message I bring to New York and when I'm at the United Nations this afternoon, talking to the big business leaders about the need to be socially responsible. Without it, the wheels of the economy don't turn.
Yeah, without it, people can't buy the products that businesses make, and we end up, as you know, as you pointed out, back into the Depression era, because the one thing we learned, we'll work for food wasn't a low enough wage.
That's it, and we've got this wage. The situation in the world is as follows. There are 3.2 billion people in the world's labor force. 50% of them are surviving on a couple of dollars a day. And 80% of all that working population have no form of social protection. This is not sustainable. You will not get the wheels of the economy turning if you don't have demand, and you create demand by putting money back into workers' pockets. You put money into workers' pockets by making sure there's a union in every workplace which is free of fear, free of discrimination, to enable people to begin to negotiate a fairer distribution of wealth. At the moment, it's all done on the terms of the other side of the table. They are making hay. They are making more money than they could have ever imagined in their lifetime while the rest of us suffer. That's why, whilst I was here, I also went to speak to the Occupy Wall Street movement. I had a great discussion with the young people there, and they are fighting for the American dream.
And that's exactly what this is about.
Best of luck and strength to them. Americans should rally to their cause.
I'm absolutely right there with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Philip Jennings, General Secretary of UNI Global Union. He's in New York at the UN Global Compact Board meeting. You know, when I look at all of this, to me it comes down to our insane trade deals that have put us in direct competitions with nations that are basically exploitable by people like Walmart. You know, I have a friend who calls China Walmart with an army. And, you know, it's there's a lot of truth in it, but the idea is that we're competing with people who, as you've said, dollars a day.
Yeah.
And I just don't see how that's a sustainable path, but we've been led to believe these free trade agreements, this is the way to go. At some point, don't you have to think that fair trade is the way we should be looking?
There's no question that that during the course of the last 40 years, one of the great dynamics of globalization, in addition to technology and the growth of global business, is the sheer ease with which it is possible for businesses to establish in other countries. My organization, Uni Global Union, has spent its time, along with the other global unions, bringing democracy and freedom and human and trade union rights to countries around the world. We wanted to give people a voice in their societies, and we wanted to get a more transparent, a functioning society, a democratic one. I think we underestimated the power of business to take advantage of the situation, and trade deals have fueled it. We've said right from the beginning that if you're opening up the world to trade, then at the same time you have to be open up to the idea of fairness and social sustainability.
Right.
All the emphasis has gone on to make sure that the terms of trade are in the favor of the business community, with very little commitment to the development of the people. The priorities on developing markets, developing a business presence, and then a second-hand thought is, what does that mean for the people who are working in these countries? So now we have this global competition for inward investment, and companies and countries going to all extents to dictate terms. We've now got tens of millions of people working in export processing zones where all health and safety legislation is suspended, where no taxes are paid, where there are no unions allowed, where you can't negotiate a deal, and it's led us to this collapse of what I would call the social contract in the world today. And liberal trade regimes have led us in this direction.
Yep.
Trade without a social dimension is not going to bring social cohesion.
You know, one of the things that I've always said is the one thing that we need in our trade policies is not to be setting countries up in these export models where it's their entire national income is based on what they can ship out, and the U.S. and Europe being the consumers of last resort, which is kind of how the globe's been set up. The IMF goes in and, you know, here's some money. You set up your business, privatize all of your social functions,
yeah,
and you export everything. But when there's a hiccup here or in Europe, those countries suffer even greater.
Oh, indeed. And the export-led model means, you know, someone's export is somebody's imports. And what we have is this huge imbalance in the world economy. And there are some countries who could do more, what I would say, to develop internal consumption.
Yep.
In the United States of America, approximately 70% of the GNP is devoted to the consumption of what consumers spend. In China, it's around 35%. So it's very important in China that they, and in India for that matter, that you've got 40% of the world's population in two countries, more or less, need to develop internal demand. You build internal demand by having an organized workforce that can negotiate terms and conditions of employment, which can raise the price of wages. Now, in China, that's what's happening on the ground. There are new mechanisms taking place to build in more consumption and to try and to develop internal demand. But what people have to realize is to generate internal demand, you need to have people in work. And I'm just astonished when I'm in the States just a couple of days that the politicians, Obama's got a jobs plan, which is right, and then all of a sudden, to get a deal on payroll tax, you have to build an oil pipeline from Canada to the south.
And deregulate.
And more deregulation in a country which is already the most deregulated.
Well, I mean, this whole idea, and I think it's kind of catching on global because the business interests are the ones that they're trying to attract. It's this idea of cut, gut, and punish. If we can cut taxes for the very wealthy, if we can gut social programs and punish those poor people, somehow this confidence fairy is going to sprinkle some pixie dust on big business, and they're going to invest. I don't see how shrinking the economy, I don't see how starving workers is going to grow your economy.
No, it's not going to grow it. And I think, we're all very taken with the American dream. And I remember this was a phrase that was coined by a guy called James Truslow Adams. And there's a part of the quote that nobody mentions anymore. And I want to bring it to your attention, Rick. And he said, this is in 1931 now, he says, ever since we became an independent nation, each generation is seen as an uprising of ordinary Americans to save the American dream from the forces which appear to be overwhelming it. This is something that falls off the quote when you look at it in newspapers and so forth. What it means is that the American people once again have to fight, ordinary Americans have to fight to save the American dream. And it's not going to be a passive fight. They have to get active, get organized, get vocal, and put jobs and decent work as the number one agenda item. And when jobs and decent work is pushed up the political agenda, you'll start putting demand back into this economy. You'll start seeing investment in this economy. You're not going to grow this economy by cutting the taxes of the top 0.1%. It doesn't work.
I'm right there with you, which is why I'm so encouraged by what we're seeing, not just here in the U.S. with the Occupy movement, but across the globe. People saying, you know what, we've been exploited long enough, we demand a fair shake, and we demand jobs. And I'm just shocked that the unemployed in this country, some 15 million, aren't all in mass out in the streets demanding. We've done it in the past. You go back to the 1880s, 1890s, Coxey's army, people, out in the street marching.
Yeah.
I
think the Occupy movement has touched a vein. I think it sent a very strong message to the political and business elite in this country. I think this idea that they speak for the 99% has a clear resonance. And I think the Occupy Wall Street movement, it's not just about occupying the few meters of Wall Street. It also means that they have to go out into communities and talk face to face with people. That another possibility, another kind of world is possible. And I'm hopeful that can be done. Around the world, working people are taking a stand.
Yep.
Yesterday, I was in Sixth Avenue with the SEIU in their march for a fair contract here. People have been on the march in Europe this past week. We've had days of action in the United Kingdom, in Italy, in Portugal, in Greece, in Belgium. There have been days of action in South Africa. There have been days of action in Chile. There is a general feeling of dissatisfaction, and we've never seen the indicators that we're seeing about social unrest. Don't forget, it's just at the beginning of this year that we had the Arab Spring.
Right.
And where we're working in those countries now is to build a proper trade union movement so working people have a voice. We now have the new possibilities in Burma. They've got the message. Now people are taking to the streets in Moscow in numbers that has never happened. This is a sign of social unrest, a falling in social cohesion, and a desire to change. And that's why the business community should be taking stock of this situation of anger and disenchantment. They can change tack, and they should.
Absolutely. Last question I've got for you. You know, here in this country, we keep hearing about immigration, and it's all across the globe. Countries who, poorer workers are coming in. There's going to naturally be a resistance. But here in this country, the idea is that we have all these Mexican people coming into the country in an undocumented fashion, taking all these jobs, supposedly. My question is, for this all to work, for us to, as a working class, as a society, don't we have to reach across borders and have labor unions? And I'm sure it's a lot of what you're doing, reaching across borders and making these international compacts to when these global multinationals go from one country to the next, that the workers in those countries are protected.
I tell you, in Mexico, we have a rotten situation. I was there just 10 days ago. And Mexico is hosting the G20 summit next year. And I tell you what, it is very, very difficult, nigh impossible, to organize a free and democratic labor union in that country. The whole labor relations scene is a racket. It's full of corrupt practices, and it's all done to suppress the wages of Mexican people. And therefore, they can't realize their dream at home, so they go to other, the magnet is the United States of America. And this is a survival strategy for Mexican workers because they can't lift their wealth at home. Mexico is the most unequal country economically in this hemisphere. What we try to do is to get fair labor standards everywhere. So we have projects in Mexico to try and achieve this. And what we try to do also is that in a planet dominated by multinational businesses is to try and get those companies to sign up for what we call global agreements where basic human rights, trade union rights, and collective bargaining rights are respected. You know, it's a mountain to climb. We've got over 40 agreements, and we've got 10 million workers covered by them. But when these things work, we have a more socially responsible business and a fairer shape for the people working in there. It's a global economy with global business, so we need more global union cooperation. But I tell you what, we've got a mountain to climb, as I said, in terms of trying to change local labor situations just to enable people to form a union and to negotiate a contract.
Yeah, that's a shame about what's going on in Mexico. And there's some people who think we ought to be using our trade agreements and those side agreements for labor rights a lot more.
Yeah, they should do. Then why not? I know in Colombia, the trade deal, all of a sudden, there was a whole side agreements that were made with it with respect to the rights for Colombian workers to organize and collective bargaining. And our concern is whether this will have any meaning in Colombia, where 2,000 trade union leaders have been assassinated during the course of the last two decades.
Yep. Yeah, we shall see. I was against that from the beginning, but they passed it through anyway. Philip Jennings.
It's true. I mean, but look, trade should have a social dimension. If the terms of trade are going to be fair, then the people have to be able to organize into a union and to negotiate and have a decent work with fair social protection. And I don't think that's beyond the imagination of people to put this into place.
No.
Otherwise, our planet is not sustainable, it's not cohesive, and in the end, everybody loses.
I agree. Philip Jennings, I appreciate the time. General Secretary of UNI Global Union, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick. Bye-bye.
All right, quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
finally, radio for the rest of us, Rick Smith.
Great news, people. A hot spot of non-spotted ladybugs has been spotted in Amagansett, New York. This uplifting story is a rich organic mixture of state pride, nature's resilience, America's scientific pluck, teamwork, serendipity, and bug love. In today's hard times, we need this. Let's start with the bug. This ladybug is the classic Cochinellidae beetle with exactly 9 black spots on its red back. A benevolent and delightful creature, it's beloved by everyone from children to farmers. So beloved that it is the official insect of New York State. Sadly, and somewhat embarrassingly, however, this state official has bugged out of the state. The last recorded sighting of this ladybug species in New York was 29 years ago. Apparently a victim of competition from imported Asian and European ladybug species, as well as pesticides and the loss of habitat, only 90 of the native 9-spotteds have been seen in all of North America in the past decade. But since 2000, a team of diligent Cornell University entomologists and volunteers have kept up the search through Cornell's Lost Ladybug Project. The searchers persisted, even when New York's legislators tried in 2006 to abandon the bug that seemingly had abandoned the state. Luckily, though, legislative inertia killed that effort to replace the state insect, and the Ladybug Project kept faith and kept looking. Then, this summer, lo and behold, a volunteer spotted one sitting pretty as you please in a patch of sunflowers on an organic farm in Amagansett. About 20 more were subsequently found on the farm amidst rows of carrots, beans, and flowers, enough for the project to establish a reproducing colony, while also building confidence that more will be discovered. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep up with this bit of good bug news, go to lostladybug.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.com.
Instead of talking about how to safeguard the pensions of Americans who've retired or are about to retire, the Education Workforce Committee is going to conduct yet another witch hunt designed to prove somehow that the National Labor Relations Board is part of some vast Trotskyite conspiracy to kill jobs in the American workforce. The fact of the matter is, what's killing jobs in the American labor market is the inaction, inattention, and ineptitude of the Republican majority.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And, you know, I got to be honest, very clairvoyant there, Congressman Andrews. He said that a couple of months back, before all of the fervor, before the right wing really got their panties all in a wad. And what we've seen over the last couple of months is really an all-out assault on workers' rights, especially looking at the National Labor Relations Board, who did their job. And you look at what happened in South Carolina. The system actually worked. Had they stopped foaming at the mouth for a second to actually let their brains work, they would have realized that that's exactly how it's supposed to operate. Anyway, today, or actually it was yesterday, I guess, President Obama announced his intent to nominate Sharon Block and Richard Griffin as members of the National Labor Relations Board. Sharon Block is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Congressional Affairs at the U.S. Department of Labor. She also served as a senior attorney with the National Labor Relations Board back from 2003 to 2006. She's got a long list of qualifications. But again, that's not going to matter to the Republicans. They're not going to confirm her. It's not going to happen. Trust me, not happening. Richard Griffin, another guy, long line of credentials, served as a counsel to the NLRB, to their members for a while, also served as general counsel for the International Union of Operating Engineers. Again, another reason why the Republicans will, in fact, block both. So, basically, what's going to happen is once the recessed appointees are no longer, and I think the one woman's already gone, or if not the end of this month, the National Labor Relations Board will do nothing from now until next January, when whoever the president is will then be able to appoint some new people, and maybe you get them confirmed, or maybe you don't, and that's part of the Republican plan. to make sure that there's no avenue for workers, well, to have a voice. And now what's going on, while they've got them, while they've got workers and you know, the mechanisms to guarantee their rights kind of tied up, now they're going to spend the cash. And the people over at the Center for Union Facts, another one of these right-wing think tank groups, another one of these right-wing attack groups funded by the restaurant industry, funded by the beer industry, they're going to spend $10 million nationwide pushing some bogus ad campaign trying to get union members to say, well, I don't want my union because they only get me higher wages and benefits and pension. Why would I want them? Understand, these people are very good at manipulation. But they got a lot of money, so they're going to spend $10 million on this ad campaign of really crummy commercials. But there may be a couple people out there who fall for them. Now the right's still fomenting over the NLRB. Look, understand, the Boeing situation worked the way it was supposed to. Boeing and the machinists, they worked it out. The question is, do we have rights in this country? Do you have the right to strike, or don't you? That eventually is going to make it all the way through. And what Leif Solomon said recently, he said, look, you know, if we face a similar pattern, like with Boeing, he said we might as well file a complaint. It may happen if you have the same set of circumstances. So the right's going nuts, going, see, they want to kill jobs. So this Austin Scott, South Carolina Republican, he has come up with the Protecting American Jobs Act. Gotta love the name. What he wants to do is he wants to take all the funding away from the NLRB. In fact, he wants to take all of the judicial powers, so they can make none of these rulings. They can issue none of these complaints. And I'm not quite sure what his idea of what the NLRB will be then. He's saying that taxpayers shouldn't pay for this agency. The unions and corporate America fight it out in the courts. And understand, this is exactly where corporate America doesn't want to be. So I'm assuming this is going to get squashed really quickly, because corporations know the NLRB is the best place to be, because most of the time they get a pretty favorable shake. You don't want to go into the court system where I may sit on a jury, or other working people may sit on a jury and go, we agree with those working people. Now, understand, there's a case coming up right now, and I'm not sure how it's going to go. Have you ever heard of Colt Firearms?
Yes.
They're made up in West Hartford, Connecticut. Evidently, what they're doing right now, they're in the middle of contract negotiations, and it's kind of the same scenario. It's almost the same scenario as with Boeing. They're talking about moving their plant to South Central Florida. Understand, Colt Firearms has been in Hartford, Connecticut for 175 years. And now they see an opportunity to, wow, we can stick it to those workers. We can kick them out, get rid of that union. We can go down to good old right to work Florida. We can get some tax money out of it. And we can screw those people over. And I'm telling you, if it happens, I think the NLRB has to step in and has to go after them the same way. Because what's going on is, you know, they're running away from having to pay decent wages. You know they're running away from having to provide benefits. 175 years. Think about that. I mean, it's absolutely amazing to me. Then again, I go back to why I'm in favor of, you know, I had a couple people ask me why I'm in favor of people out in California shutting the ports down. This is the reason. When this stuff happens, when they take you the mechanism for you to solve problems away, you've got to take it into your own hands. And we've got to get used to shutting things down again. We've got to get used to taking to the streets. We've got to get used to working together and taking this nation back. And it starts day by day, incident by incident.
And the old adage that power only exceeds the power is absolutely right. You got to make them pay. You got to make them lose money from their pocketbooks, and then maybe they'll listen.
But they're just foaming at the mouth over the NLRB. And again, as I've said, it worked exactly the way it was supposed to. The two sides came together. They made an agreement. That agreement's been honored. Isn't that what the Republicans preach?
Absolutely.
Get government out of the way. We don't need government in there. But they want to put themselves into the middle of that.
I guess the question I have about the NLRB, couldn't the president make an appointment?
He can recess a point, but the Republicans aren't going to allow that to happen because they haven't allowed them to recess. The Democrats did it to Bush, if you remember. Jim Webb used to show up every day, gavel in, gavel out. The Republicans can do the same thing. As I understand, they've already said that there could be no recess appointments. They're going to have to appoint these. And look at all of the judges, look at all of the openings, all of the confirmations that haven't happened. The Republicans really have done a masterful job of shutting government down without actually shutting it down. In fact, you may have to wonder how much money have we saved by not filling positions and not having work done. Now, granted, the work is piling up, and if you listen to the federal judges going, we need help, we're overworked, we're dying here, we got problems. But the Republicans have refused to let Obama have any appointments, and they have blocked just about every one of them. When was the last time you heard of a confirmation hearing that went well?
I haven't.
Exactly. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We're right back.
This is why we fight, why we lie awake. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick's
old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the globe. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you very much.
So Snow White and her little dwarfs having their last debate before the Iowa caucus, I see.
And Rock Paul is doing pretty well there. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, I kind of liked what Chris Wallace said. If Ron Paul wins, it was something like, if Ron Paul wins, well, then I don't know.
the question is, what happens if Ron Paul wins Iowa, Romney takes New Hampshire, and we have Gingrich taking South Carolina? Then what?
Then we have another situation like we had in 2008 where, you know what, maybe Pennsylvania is somewhere in the hunt.
Think so.
And it'll bring a lot of money to the state, and maybe if they continue that scheme that they threw out here not too long ago, they got everybody all upset about maybe assigning our electors by congressional district, maybe that'll bring even more money in.
Oh, it's all about money, honestly.
It's, you know, and until we get the money out of it, it's not going to be any less corrupt. It's not going to serve my needs anyway. I mean, you look at this payroll thing, which is just nuts in my opinion, that we cannot get a sane, rational bit of revenue from the wealthiest people in this country to help folks who are struggling.
And the Democrats back off.
As everyone knew they would. I mean, you know, come on. This is what Democrats do.
It's really quite astounding. Quite astounding.
So what did the president have to say on this today?
Well, I mean, the president basically said he was talking about the 2% payroll tax bill. And today he met with the press on that. We have to be doing pool today, so Jeff was there. And by the way, the way it works in Washington is we do pool every 10 days at the White House. But he basically said it's going to require some action from Congress to boost the economy. And million Americans don't see their taxes. We don't want to see a million Americans see their taxes go up January 1st. He said it would not be good for the economy. He said this Congress cannot and should not leave for vacation until they have made it happen. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to extend these things, and of course, payroll taxes being one of them.
Well, this is exactly the reason why the Republicans are going to block it, why they're going to do everything to water it down, dilute it, why they're going to get their pounds, not just a pound of flesh, you know, their gorilla-sized pound of flesh, because they know that if the economy ticks up a little bit, that black guy in the White House, he's going to have a better shot come next November.
That's right, and he is going to have a better shot given, as you would say, I love that quote, I always quote you on him, the seven dwarfs.
Yeah, and ever since Cheesy left, I mean, it hasn't been as fun.
You are so funny. No, but the question is he going to make it up to the New Hampshire primary?
I'm hoping. I'm praying that we get to sit down and just have 5 minutes with the Godfather. Just 5 minutes, that's all.
That'd be kind of fun.
Absolutely. It's the whole reason we're going, for that opportunity. You know, the rest of them, there's really no fun there. I mean, Mitt Romney.
Michelle Bachmann's kind of fun.
Yeah, I want to get a picture with her. I absolutely do, because I love crazy.
You should put it up on your wall.
She's my idea. She's my dream woman. Crazy and all. Those are the type of people that you pursue. You marry sane, you pursue crazy. And she would be someone I would have pursued to the ends of the earth. Because she's absolutely crazy.
Who was it that? Was it one of the TV or print publications in Washington that put This Week in Crazy? That's what they did.
Yeah.
And then they would talk about all the crazy politicians.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful. I mean, I'm sure she was the homecoming queen.
Well, she's a homecoming queen. It's about what she's going to be in these primaries.
You know, my question is why is she even there at this point? I mean, she's not polling anywhere that would even give her. I mean, in Iowa, she's not even really being talked about. And didn't she win some straw poll?
Yes, she won the straw poll in Iowa, which is what propelled her for like a month.
And all that was is she bought enough straws.
Yes, and the way the straw poll works is you pay a lot of money an organization to get your people to the straw poll.
Yep. Yeah, we'll see. And hopefully
that's not a democracy. That's
bribery.
That's
bribery. So 13 people voted against the defense authorization bill? What's up with
that? That's right. Yeah. Republicans and Democrats.
Any reason why? I mean, is it a bad bill?
Yeah, we didn't get to talk to them. I mean, it happened this evening or early early evening. And there was the White House basement Christmas party, and there was the correspondence Christmas party on the Hill, and nobody went to find out why they.
Right.
I'm sure there's some diehard people that did, but we didn't.
There's a lot of partying going on.
I'm embarrassed to admit, but it was Christmas Day.
So now that the defense authorization thing has gone through, it's got to. Does this mean they're just going to leave?
No, there's 9 bills that they're going to put in an omnibus appropriations bill. And as Lisa Murkowski from Alaska said, well, she made reservations to go home Friday, Saturday, and now she'll make them on Sunday. But rumor has it that they will be done by the end of the weekend.
Okay, so my question then becomes, if they get this defense authorization bill pushed through and we can fund the government, we don't have the shutdown threat, do they go home without passing the payroll tax?
That is the $64,000 question. Nobody knows whether that's going to be attached to the omnibus bill or not. My guess is that it will, because President Obama said that he was going to keep them in session if it does not pass.
Good, 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 good. Showing a little bit of spine. In fact, today did a very nice thing with this overtime, moving folks who do home health care and moving domestics into the Fair Labor Standards Act. I think a smart thing.
Very, very smart thing. And as he said, that automatically will put more money into the system because those people are going to have a little more extra money to spend on going out to dinner or buying a consumer product, that kind of thing.
Or paying their rent or being able to do the things that they should be able to do.
Absolutely. but I think the hope is that it somehow stimulates the economy, too.
Yeah, well, it's about dignity to me anyway. And speaking of crazy, lastly, the sheriff from Maricopa County got himself in a little hot water, it appears.
Well, yes. The Justice Department has apparently been looking at him for a very long period of time. And they have been concerned about him because they feel like he has been unfair. There's been some stories about if white women had a sexual problem in the jail or something, he paid attention to it. But if Latino women did, he didn't. But his arrest records were unfairly targeted towards the Latina community or Latino community. And so he's in some real trouble, and the Justice Department is looking at it.
Now, I'm looking at the name of Pio. Is that... I'm trying to figure out what that is. What nationality would that be?
I had no idea. You know, I interviewed him, and he just seemed like one of those guys from Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, because
he kind of, you know, looked like him. Oh, he was the big in the Republican convention of 2000 in Philly. He was the big guy.
Huh. So, is there any chance of the sheriff for life of Maricopa County finding his way to the little tents in the pink underwear himself?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that it's going to be those tents. I think it would be a little farm camp, but most likely they'll find him or hold him in violation. I don't know if they can get him for something criminal. That's what I don't understand.
Yeah, see, that's what should happen.
Well, yes, but...
Well, we are talking about politicians, aren't we?
That's right.
Ellen, always great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Now to find out what's going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jacob?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. For those of you who have an electric car, and I know there aren't that many, but hopefully in the future we'll see more and more of them. Apparently the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection is looking ahead. They, on Wednesday, announced a $1 million grant to Car Charging Group LLC. The company will install charging stations at 17 Turnpike Service plazas. Two kinds of charging machines will be installed in three phases. There will be a level 2 charging machine, which can charge a car in about 4 hours, and a level 3 charging machine, which can charge a car in only 20 minutes. The first phase of the work will be incorporated into ongoing service plan renovations between Harrisburg and New Jersey. The second phase will go from Harrisburg to Ohio. And the third phase will go in the northeastern section of the turnpike. So all you people who have electric cars, you can now travel on the turnpike. I think that's good news.
Yeah, all one of you.
Well, I understand that GM is having problems with some of their cars, but really, Rick, long term, I think that's showing some foresight on their part. And I do believe you'll see a time when you'll see a good number on the road. We got a way to go, but hey, you know, we got to become self-reliant as far as energy, and I think it's what they're doing, I think, is a good step. Patriot News editorial board article. Normally I don't look at things like that, but they made a comment about the whole article, and I thought it was outstanding, on the Pennsylvania congressional map. And their comment pretty much was, it's ridiculous, and unfortunately we got to live with it for 10 years. As you know, last night, by a slim margin, it was passed. Only a day after it was released, this time, and this has caused a lot of furor within the Republican Party, there was no public input. The public was not allowed to have any input prior to the vote. If you remember several weeks ago when they first came out with the reapportionment plans for the State House and Senate, there was a big furor. There was a lot of public input, especially from Cumberland County, and eventually they changed the reapportionment for some of the districts that got the most criticism. This time, there was none. And just to show you how ridiculous it is, Cumberland County, which used to be part of the 19th District, it was a district that made a good deal of sense, with much of its coming from Adams, York, and Cumberland. The new map, most of Cumberland County is tacked on to the 11th District. It's a long, thin shape whose heart is in Hazleton, a good 100 miles away from Carlisle. So you're going to have a district that was only shaped for one reason, pure politics, going from Carlisle, a very thin district, to Hazleton and beyond. that makes no sense at all. Dauphin County probably was even worse. For the last decade, Dauphin County has been represented by one congressman, Congressman Colden. The new makeup will have three congressmen in a configuration that appears designed just to ensure Harrisburg itself will be disenfranchised. The city is now going to be represented by, drum roll here, Rick, the 4th District going to be represented by Todd Platts, one of your favorite teams. To accommodate that, the southeastern part of Dauphin County is now going to be part of the district that stretches all the way to Northampton County on the Pennsylvania-New Jersey border. That's another district that will be in excess of 100 miles that makes absolutely no sense from a practical standpoint. These last two paragraphs, I gotta read this verbatim because it says it all. Said it is comical now to look back at comments in January by House Majority Leader Mike Terzai and Senate Majority Leader Dominic Pileggi, vowing that openness and transparency would be the guiding principles of this year's redistricting. Instead, the guiding principle were Republican protection at the expense of common sense. True words were never spoken. I mean, it's a joke, and again, and we've said it on this show before, but I think Pennsylvania seriously needs to look into the way that they go about the process of reapportionment every 10 years. Big announcement this week, we're getting out of Iraq. The U.S. had a big ceremony. There were 4,500 Americans that were killed over there, 32,000 dead, and more than $800 billion in cost. What caught my eye, Defense Secretary Panetta said earlier this week that the war has not been in vain. Started me thinking, and you know, there's just a couple of things I wrote down, and I think since the war's at an end, I think there's a couple of things that need to be said. First of all, the price we paid in debt and financial sacrifice, officially it was $800 billion, far too much. The false premises that we were given to go into Iraq. The neocons in the Bush administration took every opportunity to try to tell the American people that there were weapons of mass destruction. They had been pushing for going into Iraq since as far back as 98. They made speeches, several of them. They used the 9/11 as an excuse to go into Iraq. I do believe that we were deliberately misled into that war. The alternatives. I do believe that given the situation of Iraq, and Iraq, you remember, Rick, was in economic, it was a basket case. It was horrible. We had a UN embargo. We had a no-fly zone. We were just tightening and tightening and tightening the noose, and I do believe at some point I think Saddam Hussein would have been overthrown, and I think the consequences to the American people would have been far better off as a nation. Long-term cost, including the cost of taking care of the injured veterans and those with mental and emotional problems, there are some experts, if you look long-term, the huge cost, some have estimated it at close to $3 trillion, the ultimate cost at a time when we're in deep debt. The initial loss of respect among other nations. We were looked down upon as a nation that invaded another country and did really invaded a country that wasn't a threat to them. This was the first time in our history, Rick, where we actually had a huge tax break at a time when we should have been asking people to sacrifice. And last but not least, it was the damaging effect of the war against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. I said this several times, and I still hold this against Bush. We had originally earmarked 400,000 troops going into Afghanistan. I think that would have been adequate to go into the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan and really put a job in Al-Qaeda. What happened? The Bush administration all of a sudden decided to take most of those troops, send them into Iraq, and we wound up only sending 40,000 troops, which is totally inadequate. And to this day, we're still in Afghanistan. And I think that was a major, major mistake. At the end of the day, you got to conclude that it was the biggest mistake in U.S. military history. It was a sad, sad story of a war that absolutely should never have been fought. Back to you, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. We're right back to wrap this up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
On June 25th, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, a segment you missed, you want to hear again, therickSmithShow.com is where we have all of our programs archived. You can download the podcast there. If you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. Also, if you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, I do answer all emails personally. So yesterday we talked about Time Magazine naming the protester as the person of the year. Well, according to the Borowitz Report, Fox News has named Pepper Spray the person of the year. Fox News Channel made history today by naming Pepper Spray the person of the year for 2011. Fox anchor Megyn Kelly noted the historic nature of the nod, indicating that Pepper Spray was the first food product, essentially, to receive such prestigious recognition, from Tierra Square to Lower Manhattan to UC Davis to Walmart. Brave little Pepper Spray was there, Miss Kelly added. She continued by saying, I'm teared up a little right now, which I guess is the effect that Pepper Spray has on people. It truly is, she says, the little crowd control weapon that could. News of the awards stoked speculation that Pepper Spray might soon be given its own nightly show on Fox. According to one network source, one format being considered would involve a canister of pepper spray interviewing members of the so-called Occupy movement and then spraying them in the face. So there you go. Time Magazine names the protester. Fox names Pepper Spray. I don't know if you saw this, but in the UK, what they've done with their police force or military force is they have their cops all all decked out with the latest technology. Understand, London is the city with more cameras than any city in the world. New York's trying, but I don't know if they'll keep up. All the cops have little shoulder-mounted lasers. Little lasers. We'll see you tomorrow night.
The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the foot of sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the U.S.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.